Committee on Environment and Land Use. I appreciate everybody being here today. Just to let the audience know where we're going here. We have one bill today where we will have a significant amount of testimony. That is Senate Bill 570. There's a number of other bills that I'm hoping we can move through fairly quickly, have work sessions, pass them out. On those bills, I'm hoping to have a minimum of testimony, just enough to outline the issue, and we'll pass them out because today is somewhat of a deadline. I don't think it's necessarily a hard deadline, but I'd like to move through those bills as quickly as we can. So I'm going to start running through those bills. Hopefully we'll get to Senate Bill 570 fairly quickly. So with that, I'd like to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 389. If you could get all the sheets. Is Jared Rodford here? Jared, could you come forward very quickly, please?
This is the remote.
Good morning.
Morning. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jared Broadfoot, representing the Oregon chapters of Safari Club International. We were the ones who requested Senate Bill 389. 389 addresses a problem that was created by an individual in Texas who decided to hook a rifle up to a computer and then broadcast that to the internet, so an individual basically anywhere in the world could log on to his internet site, pay some money, and then either target practice with live ammunition or shoot animals on his ranch. We immediately took a position of opposition to this practice as it does not meet our standard for ethical and fair chase hunting. There's no part of this practice that is hunting to us. You're not in the field. You're not actually pursuing your game. You'd be sitting on a computer at home. A lot of folks actually thought this was a video game, but it is live, actually, taking of an animal.
Which amendments are you supporting?
Mr. Chair, we're supporting the Dash 3 amendments. We feel they give the Department of Fish and Wildlife the overall authority and flexibility to properly address this issue through a rule. As we started to walk through this issue, we found it was very complicated to define in statute, so we wanted to make sure to give the department flexibility in rule, but it is our intent, and we did want to put on the record that we do expect and hope this committee will impress upon the department that we want them to adopt rules as soon as possible on this issue.
Okay. Thank you very much. Questions? I've got several other people up here to testify in favor of it, but I'd rather skip right to ODF and W. Roy Ellicker, are you here? And Ron Anglin?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Roy Ellicker, Deputy Director of the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. With me today, Ron Anglin, Wildlife Division Administrator. Directly to the Dash 3 amendments, Mr. Chair, the department would like to see those. We support the Dash 3 amendments. Just get to the point.
What's that?
Just to get to the point.
Okay,
I know you have a big schedule.
No,
we support the Dash 3 amendments, and
okay,
we will be taking action on this if the statute passes.
And there's no fiscal on this because it says may establish rules. Is that why there's no fiscal?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm not sure. It would just be simple rulemaking at this point, and if there would be some slight fiscal, but certainly wouldn't be anything large. And
okay,
why the word may rather than shall, that's a legislative council term discussion.
Okay.
I'm not sure why.
Okay. Thank you very much. Appreciate it. There are a couple of other people signed up to testify, Rod Harder and Al Elkins. You're good on it, right?
Okay.
Good. Chair closes the public hearing on Senate Bill 389, opens a work session on Senate Bill 389. Senator Atkinson.
I'll move the Dash 3 amendments to bill.
Senator Atkinson has moved the Dash 3 amendments to Senate Bill 389. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Senator Atkinson moves Senate Bill 389 as amended to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Beyer, you want to carry that bill?
Yes.
And chair opens a work session on Senate Bill 351. Committee staff, if you could just review this bill for us, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we have, well, this bill does a number of different things in its printed form. We have six separate amendments which changes the Senate Bill 351. My understanding is that all parties are in favor of the dash four amendments, which delete section two from the bill, which would have eliminated the requirement to have transport permits. Section one and section three would be retained. I believe that the proponents are also now, and I think these came from Senator Byer's office, are in favor of the dash six amendments, which delete section four from the bill, which was that grandfathering clause issue that we were concerned about in the last meeting. The other significant amendment that was under discussion at the last meeting was the dash three amendments, which would impose a 3.15% fee that would mostly go for the purpose of running this private fish hatchery advisory committee that's proposed in section three of the bill. I don't think a consensus was reached on that particular issue. Now, let's see.
The dash, what's that?
I'd like to skip off.
Which one is the advisory committee? So which one's
the sixes and the threes, if you want.
And what would the three?
The three. Okay.
Joe Rollator, could you come up here and enlighten us on these, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Joe Rollator.
Thank you.
I represent the Oregon Aquaculture Association. Senate Bill 351 has three parts. The first part takes the prohibition against raising sturgeon except for scientific and research purposes out of statute. The second part was a change to the way transportation permits were written, and the third part is an advisory group on aquaculture. The fourth section of the bill removed the section in statute that protected the folks that were in business prior to 1989 when Section 1 was put into statute. We've proposed several amendments to this. We'd like to move the dash 4 amendments, which remove the transportation section of this bill, Section 2.
Okay.
And we'd also like to move the dash 6 amendments, which restore the grandfathering clause that was put into the statute in 1989, and that's 498.222. And thank you, Mr. Chairman.
But the dash 3 is out of the advisory committee.
The dash 3s were a self-tax that we placed, we proposed to place on ourselves a tax of 3.25% to pay for the program. Mm-hmm. ODF&W in negotiations with us said that wasn't enough, and so we're going to hold that amendment until we have the discussion later on about, there's some discussion now about reducing the fiscal on that so that our tax is enough. I just heard a rumor about that last night. I didn't hear it directly from ODFW, so I don't know what's going to happen to that, but we'd like to hold the dash 3 amendments until later.
You'd like to keep them off until later?
That's correct.
My understanding is that there's a fiscal on this. We had discussion earlier about whether the fiscal reflected the bare necessity of what was in the bill or whether it included some other items that ODF&W thought would be nice to do but not necessary under the bill. Your understanding, what is the proper fiscal on this?
I don't believe that we ever came to a clear understanding with ODF&W of what was absolutely necessary. We understand that the fiscal reflects what ODF&W would like to see in terms of scientific rigor on the sturgeon issue and support for the task force. But like I said, we never came to a clear understanding of that. So I think there would be a fiscal on it, but there's already some effort within the department for sturgeon propagation and working with our association members. So where that falls, I don't know.
Would you be happy with the Dash 3 amendments with a fee if that was sufficient to take care of the funding issue so it could move directly to the Senate floor?
I'd have to consult with my clients first on that. We're not prepared to move the Dash 3 amendments yet. You might ask Senator Beyer to comment. He's been he wrote the bill for us, or drafted at the bills were drafted at his request.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I think right now, Mr. Chair, to be fair, to give this bill the best chance of getting through the process, I think the best thing we do would be to adopt the Dash 4 amendments and the Dash 6 amendments and actually move the bill through the Ways and Means process.
Because
I've had extensive conversations with the chair of the Natural Resources Sub of Ways and Means.
Okay.
And she's agreed to work with me to get this bill through the process. And I think that would probably be the best way to facilitate this bill moving.
Okay. Very well, then. Chair moves the adoption of the Dash 4 amendments to Senate Bill 351. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair moves the adoption of the Dash 6 amendments to Senate Bill 351. Is there any discussion? Is there any objections? So ordered. Chair moves Senate Bill 351 as amended to the Senate floor. Chair moves Senate Bill 351 as amended to Ways and Means for additional action. Is there any discussion?
Well, we do pass.
We do pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Is that good, Senator Atkinson?
Thank you.
And the other one, isn't 352 the other one?
Oh, we can't do that right now.
Most, I suppose.
Yeah. Did we get amendments on 733?
Yes.
Okay.
And Jeff is here.
Is Jeff here? Okay. Chair opens a work session on Senate Bill 733. Jeff, did you want to come up and comment on this bill, please?
Mr. Chair?
Yeah.
Just curious, I haven't heard anything about Senator Shields or Mike. Is he giving us an update? Do you know anything more?
My understanding is he's checked out of the hospital.
He's home.
Oh, yeah. So they did. So yeah. They checked out okay.
Yeah. He should be here Monday.
Oh, great.
They're not quite sure what the situation is.
Go ahead. Give us your wisdom on 733, please.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jeff Bissonnette, representing the Fair and Clean Energy Coalition. With me is John Miller to answer any technical questions you might have. Before you is the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 733, which you heard a little bit ago. This is a restructuring of an existing solar tax credit. What these Dash 1 amendments do is basically limit the tax credit from the original version of the bill. It focuses rather than on a series of renewable energy technologies only to photovoltaic systems. And we did that primarily because it was our intention just to have it very narrow. It has zero impact for the current biennium and a revenue impact of, I think, $500,000 for the 07-09 biennium. My understanding, though, is that this is going to the Senate Revenue Committee, where we're prepared to make sure that it's ready to go and doesn't have an adverse impact. But this is narrow. We worked it out with Department of Energy, and we're ready to go and have a discussion at Revenue.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Move the Dash 1.
Senator Atkinson has moved the Dash 1 amendments to Senate Bill 733. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the bill to the Committee on Revenue with the due pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved. Thank you very much. Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 733 as amended to Revenue with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Which one? Chair opens a work session on Senate Bill 834. Who's here on this bill? Could you come on up, then, Eric? Do we have amendments on this prepared?
No, there's no amendments.
Okay, come on up. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Eric Schmidt. I'm with the Association of Oregon Counties, and this is a bill that has definitely the backing and support of the Association of Oregon Counties and a number of county governments, as well as local farmers. We're hoping that you'll be able to put it through your committee today.
And this has a substantive referral to Ways and Means.
Yes, it does.
Yes. Okay.
Mr. Chair,
yes.
I would move that we move Senate Bill 834 to the Committee on Ways and Means for the due-pass recommendation.
Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 834 to Ways and Means with a due-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Chair opens a work session on Senate Bill 890. Who's here on 890?
No one's
here. Yeah, committee staff, why don't you go ahead and introduce this? I know we have some amendments on 890.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, we did get some amendments to Senate Bill 890. Essentially, these -1 amendments would sunset the bill January 1st, 2012, so it would apply from January 06 through January of 2012. This bill creates a tax credit for costs incurred in clean energy facilities for research and development activities. And we heard about this a couple weeks ago.
Yeah, and just to remind the committee, Senator Starr came in and introduced this bill. At my request, he prepared amendments that did two things. One is it put in a sunset. Tax credits make me nervous unless there's a sunset. They're hard to get rid of. And also it put in a cap of the tax credit. And again, this will be a referral to revenue.
Oh, so isn't the cap blank right now, Mr. Chair?
Yes. But, hang on a minute.
Senator Starr is on his way down.
Oh, apparently Senator Starr is on his way down.
He probably won't mind if it's gone before he gets here.
Let's do that.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the -1 Senate Bill 890.
Senator Atkinson has moved the -1 amendment to Senate Bill 890. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, he knows it's going to revenue?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the bill as amended to the Committee on Revenue.
Senator Atkinson has moved Senate Bill 890 as amended to revenue with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Good morning, Bruce.
Are we ready to do the hemp bill? No, only kidding.
You're going to roll it?
No. Are there people here on Senate Bill 245? The housing issue?
That's a metro bill.
Just for the audience, we won't be moving Senate Bill 354 today. We won't be addressing Senate Bill 294. We won't be addressing Senate Bill 861. We won't be addressing Senate Bill 352. We already did 351. What about 593? Yeah, is anybody here on Senate Bill 593? Why don't you?
That was the one from yesterday.
Yeah, that's right. That's the one we came. Let's go ahead and open the work session on Senate Bill 593. Could you just come up briefly, please, and reorient us to this bill?
Thank you. My name is Cheryl Hummon, and I work for Defenders of Wildlife up in the Portland area. And this bill comes from a recommendation from an interim work session between the 2001 and 2003 legislative sessions. And there was broad support from state and federal agencies, as well as conservation interests, agriculture, and forestry interests for this recommendation. And it's a minor technical fix that allows a property owner with a conservation easement to have a conservation easement special assessment for their property taxes.
Thank you. Senator Beyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess a couple questions. These lands, I assume, today are either under ag or forestry special assessments.
The majority of them would be, yes.
So what would be the difference between this and those assessments?
When a property owner if a property owner had a conservation easement and it was still under a forestry special assessment, there is, in some cases, the use of the land would no longer meet the criteria for the forest special assessment. And so then they would be hit with back taxes when the county assessor discovered that the land uses with the conservation easement don't meet the criteria of the forestry special assessment.
In which way?
For example, if a landowner was interested in primarily conservation uses of their land and they were only thinning, say, for occasional forest health and not for income, the forestry special assessment requires that the land is used for timber production.
Mr. Chair, I think we need to check on that, because I believe that was the small woodland special assessment used to require that. I believe we removed that a few sessions back. I don't know if there's somebody from the forestry department that could speak to that, but it used to be a 90-year harvest date on small tract auctions, and that was either removed or greatly extended. I'm not a gray or something. I don't know either.
We worked very closely with the forestry department. They were involved in the entire process, and I can't speak to that detail. I can say that they support this bill, and they believe that it's necessary to provide the flexibility for landowners who might not meet the forestry assessment requirements anymore.
Would the land values remain the same as what they are in the forestry assessment?
The land value may not remain the same, but the assessed value would.
Well, that's what I mean. The assessed value remaining the same.
Yes, yes. That it remains the same as whatever category one was in, whichever special assessment you came from would remain the same.
And would the land be able to be transferred back and forth between these? Because currently you have an ag, you've got two different classes of forestry, so maybe even three. You've got a wildlife special assessment, and now
yes.
You create a new one. Would the land be able to transfer back and forth seamlessly between all of these?
Yes, and we paid particular attention and worked closely with Department of Revenue, Department of Revenue, to make sure that all of these would be aligned and in parallel within the statutes.
And it appeared that the back tax payment provision would be the same as the land use change. Is that accurate?
I don't understand your question.
Well, if you take land out of, say, a forest zone and develop it, you have to pay back taxes.
Yes.
Currently 5 years in forest zones, 10 years on high glass farm zone.
Correct.
I see this as that putting it in the 10 year. So if a person would be in a forest zone now, where you'd have a 5 year back tax payment provision if you changed, if you put it to this easement or this assessment instead, if you then removed, you'd have a 10 year back tax payment. So it would actually
yes.
be a penalty.
Yes, that's
versus keeping it as a forest.
Yeah, it was the statute. The proposed language makes it parallel with the wildlife habitat special assessment, which is 10 years, and that's the closest similar special assessment category.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, for indulging my questions on the issue.
You're welcome. Are you comfortable with it, or you want to?
I think it's fine. I don't know how much will be used. I think maybe it's easier just to refine the wildlife category to allow this to happen. But if this is the way they chose to do it,
some counties are not participating in the wildlife, so that's not available for some landowners.
Okay.
I'm getting my committee.
Thank you.
Do we have a motion, Senator Byer?
Are we in work session?
Yes.
Mr. Chair, I'd move the -1 amendments.
Senator Byer has moved the -1 amendments to Senate Bill 593. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move the bill to
Revenue.
Revenue as amended with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you. Senator Byer has moved Senate Bill 593 to the Revenue Committee with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? So ordered. And just for the record, the bills that we are not hearing today will be carried over to our next regularly scheduled meeting. And committee members, we will not have a meeting on Monday, because we're working so hard today and clearing things out. So we will not have a meeting on Monday, but to the next regularly scheduled meeting, we will be moving Senate Bill 542, Senate Bill 529, Senate Bill 352, Senate Bill 861, Senate Bill 294, and Senate Bill 659.
So we're almost done.
Sure. Well, we have a few more things to do, Senator Atkinson.
Mr. Chair, we meet every day this week, so what's our regular meeting time?
We'll call you.
All right.
We'll call you, Senator Atkinson.
Right.
I'm just looking at the remaining bills we have, and I've got a lot of people signed up on Senate Bill 570. How many here are signed up on Senate Bill 869? I don't see anybody. Okay, just wanted to check. Anybody here on Senate Bill 347? All right, we've got a couple people on Senate Bill 347. How many here on 696? Why don't you come up on 696? That's right. I'm sorry, I kind of skipped by this. We'll try to address it and move it out. Thank you.
Let's kill a few.
Go ahead.
I'm Anita Winkler with the Oregon Water Resources Congress. At your hearing on this bill, several of you raised some questions, and we were asked to meet with you each individually to address those questions. I think I did part of the committee. I had Senator Burdick, and I think I resolved her questions, although I'm a bit hesitant to speak for her in her absence today, but I think I resolved her questions. And I think the rest of them have been resolved as well.
Yes, and I to the committee, I had some questions about the operation of this, and I worked with some of the proponents, and I am satisfied that the bill as drafted is fine. So thank you very much. Appreciate that. Did I open a work session on this?
Must have been. Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
I move Senate Bill 696 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator Byers moves Senate Bill 696 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Atkinson, would you be kind enough
to carry it? It's just,
Senator Byer, let's allow you to carry that bill. On Senate Bill 347, I want to hear your testimony, but I'd like to do it after we do 570. So I think that'll take probably an hour or so. So I'm just giving you fair warning. You can go grab a cup of coffee or relax for a while, and we'll come back to you. And sorry to keep you waiting. So with that, let's open a Senate hearing on Senate Bill 570. I would like the proponent of the bill, Rick North, to introduce it and then immediately follow with our agricultural director, Director Koba, and then we'll go down the rest of the witnesses. But, Rick, and is there somebody else you would like to bring up with you to introduce this bill?
Well, kind of speaking on separate aspects of it.
Well, I want you to pick two or three people to introduce the concept.
This is not the appearance, but it's the genetically modified food.
Super tomatoes?
It's an interesting issue, actually.
It is. This guy's very smart.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rick North. I'm the project director of the Campaign for Safe Food. It's a program of the Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility. And I am not a doctor, but we do have one right here who will speak in a few minutes. I just want to thank you. I want to thank others, too, that we've talked to. We've been doing this for the last 2 years, working on this. The ODA, scientists, doctors, all kinds of people, and including people that are not going to be able to support this bill, but I did want to thank them because we did seek them out and meet with them and had very good discussions, and I just want to thank them for their time and their interest and their input. Senate Bill 570 places a four-year moratorium on the growing of outside crops and the use of any food crops that are considered biopharmaceutical or industrial crops. These are ones that have been genetically engineered to produce drugs or industrial chemicals. Our foundations are very simple and very clear. We believe that all drug and industrial chemical production should be in contained, controlled facilities, as they have been. And we also believe that no one should ingest or be exposed to drugs or industrial chemicals without their full knowledge or consent. And the main issue that we believe here is contamination. We think the genetic contamination of a food supply, the environment, is virtually inevitable. And we have great concerns about that and what it could do to the economic prospects of farmers and anyone in the food industry. And I will let others deal with that in particular. I just want to say we don't have any objections whatsoever. We're like everybody else. We like to see new drugs, better drugs, cheaper drugs. And we also favor a number of techniques that are considered biotechnology, and including many genetic techniques. This, however, the biopharmaceutical crops, is a very small subset of the entire spectrum of biotechnology. This is what we have the most concerns about. I've had the opportunity to talk to a lot of legislators, and I just wanted to bring up the main questions that they have brought up to me and just address them and then turn it over to other people. One, why Oregon? We do not have any of these crops being tested here now and have not for 10 years. Every state around us in the past 4 years, Washington, Idaho, Nevada, even California, have had biopharm crop testing. So there's nothing about our climate or soil that would preclude the testing here. It could happen at any time. And we wanted to take precautionary action before that happened. The question also comes up, why are we looking at regulations at a state level instead of a federal level? The USDA currently regulates these. And on a theoretical basis, and in a more perfect world, we tend to agree that the USDA have stricter standards. But frankly, we just don't see it happening. It's not coming from the USDA to restrict these biopharmaceutical crops. In fact, they have even funded the research on some of these. So it's a highly unlikely prospect. We think if we want to protect public health, the environment, and the economic prospects of farmers and people in the food business, we have to take action ourselves. And I just wanted to mention, we are one of eight states, we're not alone, in the last 2 years that have tried to enact either some kind of legislation or some kind of restrictions against biopharmaceutical crops. So there is a lot of this that has been going on as people discover more and more about it. So a lot of states feel the same way that we do. Also, some confusion regarding the biofuel bills, whether our bill, Senate Bill 570, would affect the biofuel bills, not at all. Okay, I want to state that for the record, not at all. And if anyone wants independent confirmation of this, they could talk to Karen Lewatsky or Chris Hagerbaumer or Matt Blevins at the Oregon Environmental Council. And they will tell you the same, because I've run this through them, they've looked at it, examined it, and they agree there is no connection. And finally, just in terms of some people have brought up, legislators, you know, could this possibly hurt economic prospects, job prospects, putting aside the contamination issue? One, total last year, at maximum, there were 40 of these test plots in the country. Okay, that's it. So we are talking about a very, very small handful of farmers. That's nationwide. And the number of these tests has gone down significantly since the years 2000, 2001, when they reached their peak.
Where are most of those test plots located?
A lot of them in the Midwest, a number of them in tropical states like Florida, Hawaii, where they can have multiple growing seasons, but in a lot of different states throughout the country.
And what kind of crops are the subject of in those test plots?
Corn has been the crop of choice about 70% of the time. And other than that, the ones right after that have been soybeans, tobacco, and rice.
Are there any of these test plots in California?
Yes, there have been. California has actually been the major battleground last year over a biofarm crop. A company by the name of Ventria wanted to plant more biofarm rice there, and there was a major dispute, and they were able to block it. So Ventria actually ended up moving to Missouri, and they are trying now to plant biofarm rice in Missouri, and they're thinking about Arkansas, and now there is a major effort to try to block it there. In fact, some of the major corporations like Riceland and Anheuser-Busch, they have the same concerns that we do, that this genetically engineered biofarm crop will contaminate food crops.
Could you spell out that concern in just 60 seconds? Why do you have that concern?
Well, these are drugs. Again, we're not talking about genetically engineered food production. Our bill has nothing to do with that. This is drug manufacturing. But it's outside. These plants are exposed to the environment. They're exposed to wildlife, water, insects. And there are so many chances for contamination, whether it's through some crops like corn pollination, or it's just physical mixing, or it could be through wildlife, birds that would eat the plants and go someplace else, or simply, and this is a major factor, human error. People just make mistakes, and we've already had a number of contamination incidents.
Could you explain that a little bit more? You said you're not opposed to genetically modified food. You're opposed.
Well,
that's
no.
A different issue, though.
That is a different issue. Okay. You know, and we should say no. Very much, we have great concerns about genetically engineered food.
Okay.
I'll say that for the record. Okay. We really do. We do not think it's been demonstrated safe for human consumption or the environment.
That's not what this bill is
about.
But
this bill has nothing to do with genetically engineered food.
So,
it is only the drugs.
Okay.
And industrial chemicals.
Tell me how that works with the pharmaceuticals. How do they play into the test crops?
Well, they're genetic. It's typically from one species into another. It could be a human gene put into corn. It could be a cow gene. It could be from a bacteria. You're crossing species barriers. Okay, this is something that nature could not accomplish by itself. We're not talking about traditional hybrid crops like two species of corn, or you know, two strains of corn, or a closely related species. You know, what's been done for hundreds or thousands of years. We're not talking about that kind of thing. We're talking about something. We're talking about crossing species barriers here.
Okay.
But just to finish up, just on the economic, that last question that a number of legislators have brought up in terms of, you know, could this kind of put a damper on other kind of biotechnology in Oregon, or would it, you know, send the wrong message? Somebody could not be here today, but I have his testimony, which I'm going to pass in. But I just want to read something from him. His name is Richard Sessions. And Richard served 10 years as the administrative director at the Vallum Institute at OHSU. And this is a leading molecular neurobiology research organization. So he's had that experience right there. He's also in the biotech industry. He's a co-founder of two startup biotech companies, Northwest Neurologic and Xenomics. And he's currently the CEO of Xenomics. And what he said, and he's very clear on this, he said, would enactment of this bill place a damper on Oregon's bioscience future? Not at all, in my view. Bioscientists would understand the basis for the regulation, and the vast majority of bioscience and biotechnology fields in Oregon would not be affected. Again, this is there. We want to make sure on our definitions here. Biotechnology is a very, very big field. This is a very, very small subset of it, and this is the only thing that this bill addresses, and that is what our concern is.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate
your testimony. Other questions? Yes, go ahead.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'm happy to be given the opportunity to speak on behalf of this bill. My name is Martin Donahoe, and I practice internal medicine, have done so for about 15 years, and I'm currently at the Old Town Clinic, a clinic for homeless and underserved patients in Portland. I also teach a course in public health ethics at PSU, and I'm on the board of directors of Oregon PSR, where I'm the chief science advisor for the Campaign for Safe Foods. I also love to eat Oregon agriculture, and am a person who is very much in favor in general of biotechnology, as I use it every day in my practice of internal medicine. experience with non-biofarm and biofarm GMO crops illustrates that contamination of the food supply is inevitable, a conclusion reached by the prestigious National Academy of Sciences, which stated, it is inevitable, and I quote, it is inevitable that biofarm crops will produce genetic contamination when grown in the air, end quote. Examples include the Starlink GMO incident, which led to a $1 billion food recall and cost growers over $100 million, the Prodigine biofarm contamination events in Iowa and Nebraska, Syngenta's recent admission of the accidental release over a three-year period of GMO seeds, and last year's report of the possible spread of biofarm corn by a storm in Colorado. Examples of biofarm crops under development include antibiotics, contraceptives, abortifacients, which are abortion-inducing drugs, and chemotherapeutic agents. Effects on human health from biofarm crops include pancreatic disease and allergic reactions from the blood clotting agent aprotinin, adverse reproductive consequences of anti-sperm antibody, occupational asthma from the pancreatic enzyme trypsin, vitamin B deficiency and allergic reactions from Avidin, and allergic reactions and induced abortions from the failed anti-AIDS drug triclosanthin. In the event of contamination, humans would be exposed, without their informed consent, to unwanted and potentially dangerous pharmaceuticals in their food supply. Similarly, Oregon's farmers would suffer economically, as would the reputation of Oregon's respected agricultural system. Environmental contamination would affect soil quality, as well as mammals, birds, and insects who feed upon biofarm crops, with adverse consequences including ripple effects up the food chain. Two well-known examples are aprotinin, which shortens the life of honeybees, and Avidin, which kills or impairs numerous insect species. Finally, the FDA's record of preventing the approval and at expediting the withdrawal of drugs whose benefits are outweighed by their risks shows that FDA oversight would be inadequate to protect human health from the adverse consequences of the widespread contamination that could result from biopharmaceutical open-air farming. Recent examples of FDA failures include the delayed and or inadequate oversight of the drugs Resulin, Trovan, Bacall, Vioxx, and Bextra. In conclusion, in order to protect the public's health, as well as the economic vitality and respected reputation of Oregon's farmers and of Brand Oregon, I urge the committee to approve this very important and, I believe, landmark piece of legislation. Thank you.
Thank you. You don't have your testimony in writing.
I do.
Well, maybe when my committee staff returns, we can get a copy of it. That'd be great. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for this opportunity. My name is Chris Schreiner. I represent Oregon Tilth. Oregon Tilth is a 501c3 nonprofit organization. We promote and support what we call biologically sound and socially equitable agriculture through research, education, advocacy, and product certification. Our membership represents all facets of the food system, including farmers, food handlers, retailers, and many consumers. Oregon Tilth supports Senate Bill 570, and here's why. Oregon Tilth is accredited by the United States Department of Agriculture to offer organic certification services to farmers and food handlers. Organic standards prohibit the use of genetically engineered organisms in all stages of production and handling. Many consumers rely on the organic label in the marketplace to identify products that are free of genetic, not free, but are produced without the use of genetically engineered organisms. Organic agriculture is growing. In 2000, Oregon Tilth certified 214 farms and 16,800 acres. In 2004, those numbers increased to 266 farms and 27,500 acres. Also, in terms of economic value, in 2004, the organic farms in Oregon that we certified reported gross sales of organic products at $25.3 million. Genetically engineering food and feed plants to produce drugs and chemicals they cannot naturally produce represents a significant contamination risk to our food system. This risk not only threatens the organic food system and organic farms, but all foods, all farms. Oregon Tilth supports the use of research, technology, and innovation to improve our ability to produce food that's environmentally sound, socially equitable, and economically viable. However, we believe that new technologies need to be introduced with reverence to natural systems and ecology. So in the 1950s, new chemical agents such as DDT were introduced and widely promoted and used before we had a full understanding of the toxic effects on our human health and our wildlife. Now, although those chemicals have been banned for over 30 years in Oregon, they still persist in our environment. Biopharmaceutical crops, they represent even more, a greater risk of long-term contamination, the reason being that they are materials, they're living organisms, and therefore they can transfer genetically engineered traits via reproduction and a complex food chain. Genes continue, as opposed to DDT, but DDT is still around. So in short, once the genie is let out of the bottle, it's difficult, if not impossible, to put it back. Senate Bill 570 does not stop technology or innovation. It simply lays out precautionary measures to ensure that these powerful new technologies are introduced with reverence to our natural resources, our environment, and our food system. Thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Other questions from the committee? Okay. Thank you very much. Katie Koba and Dan Stone. How many copies do you have?
I've got from like different people. So.
Oh, yeah. Why don't you maybe give them to Katie, and she'll make sure we get them all. Thank you very much.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Katie Koba, Director of the Oregon Department of Agriculture. I'm glad that you've asked Dr. Stone to come up and join me in this portion of the testimony. You've heard about Senate Bill 570 and what it would do. The Department of Agriculture and the Board of Agriculture have been engaged in several discussions around this topic in the last few months. The board actually heard from both sides of the issue at its December board meeting, and then at its last board meeting a couple of weeks ago passed a resolution talking about biofarming, and there's a copy of their resolution attached to your testimony. Basically, in these conversations, as well as in conversations with the Health Division, the position of our agency and the intent of the Board of Agriculture is to lead a policy discussion around biofarming in the interim, regardless of what happens with legislation during this session. You've heard some concerns expressed about biofarming. Basically, I think it's important to remember that biofarming is regulated in the United States by the federal government. The U.S. Department of Agriculture is currently in the process of reviewing its rules and regulations around biofarming. They're in the process of doing a thorough review, and I would expect new regulations to be issued in the next 1 to 2 years. As the previous members testified, there is currently no biofarming occurring in Oregon and no request to have biofarming trials in our state.
Just to clarify that, mm-hmm. what process would have to occur for there to be a request to carry out biofarming?
The request goes to the federal government, the USDA, and then the USDA would send a copy of that request to the state and ask us to comment on that request. Certainly, the Health Division could also comment as well. This is the process that is used, for example, when there are genetically modified field trials that go on in the state of Oregon. So we do have the opportunity to participate in the analysis that the federal government goes through. The other thing that I would mention is there is no other state that has banned biofarming in the United States. And I think there is a concern about state-to-state, individual states taking different positions on biofarming as opposed to a kind of a continuous position throughout the United States because of the fact that states' borders are close to each other. Farming operations in Washington are close to those operations in Oregon as they are in Idaho and California, and I think it probably makes more sense to have a U.S. position as opposed to a state-by-state-by-state position. But the Department of Agriculture in the state of Oregon does have an opportunity to comment on requests that go to the federal government. You've heard a little bit this morning as well as in terms of discussion around technology. And I might just say that in terms of the future of agriculture, I think in the United States as well as in the state of Oregon, technology is going to play an absolutely critical role. Let me just give you a few examples of some things that are going on. Infrared photo sensors are being used to detect weeds in fields, and then we can turn around and use spot spraying of chemicals to attack those weeds as opposed to full spraying of fields. Sensors are being placed in fields now to monitor humidity, temperature, and other patterns, and that way farmers can determine when they irrigate, how much they irrigate, when they spray, how much they spray, those kinds of things. And that nano biosensors that would be inserted in the inlet of a milking machine to monitor for bacteria presence. So these kinds of technology that are being developed in agriculture are absolutely critical for us to continue to compete in a global marketplace. When you consider the fact that Oregon or the U.S. can't produce on a low-cost basis and compete in that way with other countries in the world. So to summarize, the Board of Agriculture believes that the most important thing we can do right now is have a collaborative discussion around a policy regarding biofarming in Oregon that would both protect public and environmental health as well as allow for the continued use of technology in agriculture. The Board of Agriculture is committed to leading this policy discussion regardless of what happens to legislation, and we would like to lead that discussion in conjunction with the Public Health Advisory Board within the Health Division. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions you might have.
Thank you very much. Dr. Stone?
Thank you, Chair Ringo, and members of the committee. I'm Dr. Dave Stone, environmental toxicologist with the Office of Public Health Systems and the Department of Human Services, and I want to thank you for the opportunity to discuss the public health impacts or potential impacts of Senate Bill 570. As we've heard today, obviously biopharmaceuticals and industrial crops are a growing industry in the pharmaceutical and agricultural sectors. I do want to say that I think they have some potential public health concerns that warrant further consideration. Senate Bill 570 raises some of these issues. Pharmaceuticals are physiologically active proteins, and when I first saw this bill proposed, that's what got my attention. And they address human food and livestock feed crops. Senate Bill 570 looks at issues like the fallibility of open-air field tests to ensure zero contamination of the human food supply, the possibility of irreversible expression of modified genes in non-target organisms, the potential for human health effects such as allergenic reactions, and other unintended or unforeseen health outcomes or environmental outcomes. And at this time, there's a lot of uncertainty, reliable and consistent data to really address the safety of this process. As the agency that oversees public health matters for Oregonians, we would encourage preventative measures to minimize adverse effects to the public. The position on this bill as introduced is neutral, however, we do really encourage and are glad about the opportunity to engage with agencies such as the Department of Ag in a meaningful dialogue that would recommend measures to be protective of public health.
Thank you very much.
Chair.
Chair Byron.
Thank you. Katie, I appreciate your comments on the national and the fact that this is a national issue, and I believe it is a national issue. But to that, we know that there are trials going on in Midwest, big corn-producing states, for instance. Corn is the most common crop used. And if one of the concerns, and I believe it is cross-pollination between bioengineered corn versus food corn or animal feed corn, wouldn't it make more sense on a national basis to put those test plots in areas of non-large corn-producing states or areas such as Oregon? We don't produce much corn in Oregon. So wouldn't it make more sense, because corn pollen can travel probably, I don't know, 5, 10, 20 miles via air. So wouldn't it make more sense on a national basis to put these crops in isolated areas so to completely minimize the risk of cross-pollination with the food or human or animal food crop?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, that's certainly one of the issues that we would propose to entertain in this policy discussion. It's one of the reasons why Hawaii has been a popular place for biofarming trials, because it's a little hard to move pollen from Hawaii into the mainland U.S. But Oregon, it does have such a diverse geographical growing regions, and one of the tools that the Department of Agriculture has and we've used in the past for other issues is the use of control districts, whereby we could set up through rule areas of the state where you could grow certain products, or by default areas where you couldn't grow certain products. Most recently we had some trials of Roundup Ready bent grass, and we set a control district for that to happen in central Oregon to prevent cross-pollination of grass seed that is grown in the valley. So that is one of the issues that I think would be ripe for discussion as we hold this. Can we use and can we set adequate buffers in certain places around the state that would prevent cross-pollination to other crops?
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much for your testimony. Excuse me, Senator Starr. We already passed your bill out over in your absence. We decided to pass it anyway.
I have another one on your
public hearing. Have to take a look. Thank you very much, Dr. Koba. Which one does he have?
This is also his.
Okay. We'll probably get to that in about a half hour. Do you want us to? Where will you be?
I wrote my name.
Okay. Thank you. Terry Witt, Katie Fast.
Thank you, Chair Ringo, and member of the committee, I guess. My name is Terry Witt, Executive Director of Oregonians for Food and Shelter. We oppose Senate Bill 570, which prohibits the growing of two very broad categories of genetically engineered plants in Oregon. There's no question that Senate Bill 570 is only part of a bigger campaign against all GMOs. This extreme and unnecessary regulation imposes a ban initially impacting both agriculture and research, but it is bad public policy, and I think bad for Oregon. In the longer term, it negatively impacts future economic development in the state well beyond the simple growing of biopharmaceutical or bioindustrial plants as a viable crop in Oregon. This ban would be the equivalent of telling the entire research and development community that, quote, you are not welcome in Oregon. Why would anyone want to make a significant investment to establish a research and development facility or partner with a university like OSU or OHSU in a state where field trials are prohibited, as well as food crop research even done within a greenhouse? The answer is simple. They will not consider Oregon. This is in stark contrast to new and other emerging sciences that have been welcomed to Oregon with open arms as a potential for significant investment and future economic development in Oregon. The most notable one is nanotechnology. What is somewhat ironic is that this attack on technology of genetically engineered crops comes at the same time that many in this 73rd Legislative Assembly are extolling the benefits of biofuels, including incentives that encourage Oregon to become a producer of biodiesel from industrial farm crops grown in our state. And with I guess I would like to sidetrack a second from my written testimony. Mr. North made the comment that this bill does not impact biofuels in any way. I totally disagree with that assessment. I have talked with renowned scientists that have looked at the definitions in this bill of industrial biofarming, and they say that it is very likely that it would impact the industrial chemicals that could be used for producing biodiesel. And I would guess I would put my faith in a genetic engineer or a genetic scientist over what I was told, Rick, by Oregon Environmental Council lobbyists. Time does not really permit me, nor do I feel scientifically competent to go into great deal on the biology of plant-made pharmaceuticals, how they are processed into usable medicines, or all of the quality of life benefits this technology has the potential to provide to our society. If any member is interested, I can definitely get this information to you. I could have also paraded a long line of globally recognized scientists who support PMPs. However, I don't think these topics are really what's at issue here. What really is at issue is what, if anything, needs to be done to control or regulate crop technologies in Oregon. The growing of PMPs is already strictly regulated by the USDA's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services, known as APHIS. PMPs can only be grown under permit conditions, and those permits require extensive data submission, including details on location, proximity to other crops, seed production, timing of pollination, harvest, crop destruction, confinement of equipment, storage, and so on. Permit approval is by both USDA and also with the acknowledgement of the individual state's Department of Agriculture. Once the PMP leaves the grower's field, it is then regulated by the Federal Drug Administration, the FDA. This oversight begins with the processing stage, which starts with grinding of the plant material and extraction of the targeted therapeutic proteins, and doesn't end until the end product is all the way to its marketing and final sales stage. Currently, as was mentioned by Director Koba, there are no PMPs currently on the market, and the best estimate is that it will be at least 3 to 5 years before the commercialization of a PMP is actually realized. PMP research is underway, including various stages of field and clinical trials. At the start of 2005, permits had been issued for research-related activities in about 14 states. Of those, California, Arizona, and Hawaii, according to my research, are the only states issued permits west of the Rockies. Oregon does not have any PMPs, nor am I aware of any imminent plans for such permits. It is important to note that because OFS opposes a ban on this technology, that we do not mean that nothing should be done. With several genetically enhanced foods and non-food crops already on the market and the push to move Oregon into biofuels production, it seems prudent that the state answer the real question, which is what do we have an adequate system to isolate, maintain appropriate confinement, monitor and enforce growing of any crop, not just PMPs, that pose a real risk to other crops, the environment, and the environment includes man and animals in that environment. Such a proper functioning system is not only needed for PMPs, but is also needed for genetically modified foods, industrial biocrops, such as the biofuel oil seeds that hopefully the state will be producing to do the biodiesel, as well as even potentially problematic conventionally bred cross-pollinators. We have crops out there right now that pose a problem to neighboring crops that are traditionally bred. As you know, House Bill 2196 passed the House and moved through your committee several weeks ago to be passed on the floor and now awaits signature into law. This bill elevates the Oregon Board of Agriculture from a purely advisory role to the department director to a policymaking board to the governor and the legislature. OFS cannot think of a better policy for that board's first assignment than to review our present system using ODA's control districts and whether, if deemed deficient, make recommendations as to how the system or practices can be strengthened. In closing, we do not need a categorical ban on new and emerging technology, especially one that is not presently in Oregon. If more regulatory oversight is needed, I agree with Director Colby, it should be first done at the federal level so as to provide uniformity across all 50 states, not done locally within the state, which singles out and penalizes Oregon growers and our economic development potential. I may add here that I do agree with, I think it was Mr. North's statement, that the potential for benefit back to a grower is very minimal, and I agree with that. I don't think this is going to be a boon for farmers as a specialty crop. Where I see the real potential economic benefit to Oregon is as a leader in the technology, particularly in the research and development arena. Oregon Department of Agriculture already has authority to regulate the growing of crops across the state as a whole or within specific areas. If needed, they can refine it. This is by the use of control districts. So in closing, I say let the Board of Agriculture do a science-based, factual assessment of this issue rather than react to an emotionally driven, sensationalized attack that will cripple this important new technology, a technology that will likely play a significant role in Oregon's biofuels future. We ask that you do not pass this bill. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Witt, I just have to make a comment. To me, this is a difficult issue that really comes down to the science. I mean, there's a lot of public policy issues involved. Mm-hmm.
And it needs, the decision ought to be science-based. It doesn't help me when you call the other side extremists and say that they're sensationalizing it. I think from their perspective, it's a good faith effort on a public policy issue. But Dr. Stone, this is the Department of Human Science, Human Services, says at this time there is a lack of reliable, consistent data supporting the safety of this process. That was Dr. Stone from the Department of Human Services. So I just want to make that comment. Don't throw bombs at them. I hope they don't throw bombs at you. Let's keep us focused on what's good science. Is that fair?
Senator Ringo, that's fair. I would say, though, much of the debate has not been based on science. Using phrases like, do you want drugs in your Wheaties, is, to me, not science.
I think on all sides of these debates, there are people that will use inflammatory language, and hopefully they don't define how the debate's carried forward. But
yeah, and Senator Ringo, I do agree with you that it should be done on science. And with regard to the comments that were made by Mr. Stone, I would just point to the one comment that he makes talking about tests, and he uses the phrase to ensure zero contamination, and I would contend that regardless of what Oregon does, there's no way that we are going to ensure zero contamination. So I mean, you know, zero is a nice goal, but it's an absolute that we'll never reach.
Well, that may be true. Thanks for your testimony. I appreciate it. Go ahead.
Thank you. For the record, Katie Fast, Oregon Farm Bureau. We are here today in opposition to Senate Bill 570. I won't go over my written testimony. It's fairly duplicative to Mr. Witt's, but I do have some comments to make. And the first is, I mean, this is a science discussion, and these crops need to be grown under the best management practices based on science. And right now, I think, as with a lot of the environmental issues, there's a lot of dueling science out there and contradicting science. But that's probably our members' biggest concern. These crops are, as you've heard, are not grown in Oregon, nor would I say our members are interested right now in these crops on the pharmaceutical end. But our membership is concerned with the impact that this will have on our research facilities in the state and our ability to do the science on the safety of these crops, which ones are appropriate to be grown, which ones aren't, and under what confinement should they be grown. I'd like to also comment that I think you heard some discussion about concerns with issues with GMO crops not following their growing practices. The crops used for livestock feed are under much different regulatory practices than the ones used for pharmaceutical purposes. And in my testimonies, lined out the FDA and USDA oversight for pharmaceutical crops, which is much more stringent than other GMOs. Our membership also, as Mr. Wick pointed out, the concern with the biodiesel and biofuels packages that we're supporting here in the legislature. We do have an interest in that, and our concern is what the technology is going to be for these industrial crops in the future. A big part of the biodiesel is not just the fuel, but the lubricants that you can also produce that are of a higher value than the biodiesel. And what is going to be the technology in the future for different organic-based industrial crops and the GMO uses of that? That is something that we see we could produce here in Oregon, produce as a rotation crop, and produce in eastern Oregon where they don't have the high-value crops available to them to grow. So that is a large concern for us. We are supportive of the Board of Agriculture's look at this during the interim. However, you know, I'd like to stress it that this is a national issue. 80% of Oregon's agriculture is exported out of the state, and there are trade implications nationally as we go through trade negotiations on GMOs. And that discussion needs to be had at the USDA and FDA level to make sure agriculture and consumers are protected. And we trust that that is the best place for this to be happening. A large part of our food is not consumed just Oregon products, but consumed national and international products. So, I mean, we'd like to just stress that that is really where the safety issues need to be addressed. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. Senator Byer?
When are you going to get that biofuels bill out of that?
Well, they're going to be having some hearings next week.
Okay.
So hopefully it'll be coming to you sometime.
Thank you very much.
Thank you
for your testimony. Biddy Roy, you're a botanist, U of O. Maybe we'll get some science here. And Job Courtright?
Yes.
So are you a scientist? Can you give us the science-based spin on this?
I am a scientist. I do work with GeneFlux.
Okay. Thank you for coming this morning.
Thank you. So, although I am a botanist at the University of Oregon, I'm not speaking for the University of Oregon. I'm speaking as a private citizen.
Okay.
That should be very clear.
Yes. And your name is?
My name's Biddy Roy. R-O-Y is my last name.
Thank you.
So my specialties are plant population genetics and pollination biology, among other things. I'm also working with invasive species. I have 43 peer-reviewed publications, and I'm internationally known. Okay. And I have not been particularly against the genetic modification of plants for food. I think that it is extraordinarily frightening to think about putting things like anticoagulants into plants where we know that gene flow is extraordinarily common. So we have 20 crop species that are commonly grown in the U.S., most of them also grown in Oregon, that have close wild relatives that they grow with. So we know, and they exchange genes with. For example, if you drive around outside right now, you'll notice the wild mustards. They exchange genes readily with our crops, okay, with canola, for example. And in one case in Canada, they have found that 97% of the seed that has been tested of canola is now contaminated with genetic modifications.
97%.
We're talking about outcrossing species that readily exchange pollen, and most of our crop plants are outcrossing plants. So I'm concerned because of the potential for hybridizing with weeds. I'm also concerned because there's non-target effects on other organisms such as mycorrhizae in the soil. An example of this recently was shown with Bacillus thuringiensis, which has been introduced as a resistance mechanism, and it reduces mycorrhizae and change diversity. There's potato lines that were modified with agglutinin, and this also reduced mycorrhizae. In most cases, we have almost no data on the non-target effects. This is moving a lot faster than we've been able to keep up with. And what this bill is simply doing is asking for a moratorium. It's not saying stop. Yeah, stop research, stop everything. It's asking for a moratorium on the particularly dangerous facets of this technology, which is the pharmaceutical drugs and industrial chemicals. I'm a member of the Union of Concerned Scientists, and they have come out strongly against this particular use of biotechnology. The risk is just simply too great that it'll transfer into other species. And once that happens, you have evolution. And I'll give you an example of that. In Canada, they had released crops that were genetically modified for glyphosate resistance, which is Roundup. And they also had another kind of resistance that they genetically modified. They did them separately. Okay, and this was introduced into canola again. And it's now found, these two separate genes are now found in the wild relatives together. They weren't ever engineered to be together, but now they're together because of cross-pollination. And we simply can't have that happening with things like anticoagulants and these other kinds of drugs that we know have negative effects in mammals. Okay. And I think that just as a person who, again, I mean, we all live with technology every day and we make choices, but I think we need to be able to slow the process down to where we can think about it intelligently. And I think that's what this bill does. Thank you.
Thank you. That, do you have written testimony?
I do.
Okay. Was it submitted? Okay. We'll get it in a few minutes then. Thank you. Thank you very much. You know, Senator Beyer, did you have any questions? Thank you very much. Hi, Joe. Good morning.
Mr. Chairman, members. Excuse me. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Joe Courtwright. I'm an economist with Impresa in Portland, Oregon. I'm appearing on my own behalf and not on my company's on this bill. I'm testifying in favor of Senate Bill 570. Let me just give you a quick background on my perspective on this bill and then go through a couple of quick points. I had the opportunity to serve the Oregon Legislature for 12 years as the executive officer of the legislature's Joint Committee on Trade and Economic Development. I spent a lot of time on issues related to the development of the Oregon economy and the Oregon food processing and agricultural industries. Within the last 3 years, I was retained by the Brookings Institution of Washington, D.C. to undertake a major study of the biopharmaceutical industry in the United States. And 3 years ago, we produced a study called Signs of Life that's the definitive analysis of the geographic distribution of the biotechnology industry in the United States. And what I'd like to do today is address two things. One is, what are the risks to the state? That is, what are the economic consequences of cutting yourself out of the opportunity to grow biopharmaceutical and bioindustrial crops for, say, the next 6 years or so, as this bill would provide, and then address the positive benefits of the bill to the Oregon economy. Despite all of the acclaim and attention that the biotechnology industry has gotten in the United States, it is actually an extremely small industry. Nationally, it represents about 1,000 firms employing about 180,000 workers. And of those 1,000 firms, there are probably not more than a dozen or two dozen that are actively exploring or interested in biofarming as described in this bill. So we're talking about a tiny segment of the biotechnology industry, which in itself is a tiny industry. The likelihood that there would be any significant opportunity for Oregon farmers to grow these kinds of crops, especially in the next few years, is remote at best. So let me just say that from the standpoint of having an influence on or foregoing any economic opportunity at Oregon, you are not risking that by this legislation. On the other hand, however, let me just address the issue of how this bill or how failing to regulate these biofarmed crops could have a negative impact on Oregon. Now, you've heard a lot of discussion today about technology, and technology is clearly important to agriculture. This, however, influences almost none of the technology that is used in Oregon. It doesn't limit the application of all of the things that Director Koba told you about, for example. But equally important, in fact, more important to the long-term future of Oregon economy and the Oregon agricultural economy, is the development of new markets and the perception that customers, those 80% of consumers of Oregon agricultural products have, of the quality and healthfulness of Oregon products. As you all know, we've invested considerable resources in the state over the last decade or more in developing a very strong image of the quality of Oregon-produced products, the brand Oregon campaign, and so on. You've also heard about one of the most rapidly growing segments of the food industry in Oregon, which is organic products. And what I would suggest to you is that if we had an incident in Oregon where genetically modified products for pharmaceutical industrial purposes cross-contaminated other products, that would have a significant impact on our brand image and would have probably much more detrimental effects to our economy than foregoing this very, very limited opportunity to grow these biopharmaceutical and industrial crops. With that, Mr. Chairman, I'll just conclude.
Yeah, that's an interesting point. Thank you very much. Any questions? Okay, I thank you very much. Director Koba? Could I just ask you to follow up on his final point? I'm kind of surprising you. His point was essentially that, I guess on the one hand, if we pass this bill, there's a possibility that maybe some companies aren't going to come here to do research, so maybe there's a risk to our economy in that respect. But his point is that there's a much bigger risk that if there is an incident in Oregon, then that's going to be much more harmful to the ag economy in Oregon. I mean, is that something your department has weighed?
Mr. Chairman, absolutely. And frankly, that's a concern that I think growers throughout the state would have. If we have a grower who is going to do a biopharmaceutical field trial, I can guarantee you that this person is going to exercise the utmost caution to make sure it's done right, because we all know, and growers have seen, if you make one mistake, the ripple impacts throughout domestic and international markets are absolutely incredible. We can't afford to make a mistake. And that was the case with the Roundup Ready bent grass trials in eastern Oregon. The equipment that the people dedicated, the farmers dedicated to those crops only. They did not use that equipment in farming their other crops. The storage, all of those things are things that you take into consideration if you're actually going to do a trial. The other thing that I might mention in terms of research, part of our discussion that we had with the Board of Ag, Thane Dudson, who's the Dean of Agricultural Sciences at Oregon State University, talked about some of the opportunities out there for biopharmaceutical drugs. And it's not the scary stories that we've heard. And frankly, I don't think those are the kinds of things that we would see on the ground, particularly here in Oregon. But the use of tomatoes, for example, and enhancing, you know, some of the positive characteristics in a tomato for health purposes, I think it's those kinds of things that we would have concern about in terms of research not happening, viable research that could happen at OSU. It's not the extreme cases that we're interested in, but the ability to do research in places where we think there is not the potential for severe public health risks.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for coming up and sharing that with us. Peter Kanegi, KJ Mapala, are you here? Okay, Peter may not be here. What about, is there a JJ Mapala? Okay, well, we'll keep going down the list then. Mel Bankoff?
We've got Peter Kanegi. He's a conventional farmer.
Okay. Okay, thank you. And then Steve Strauss, you're next. Are you here? Okay, you'll be next. Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Senator and staff. My name is Mel Bankoff. I've been the founder and operator of Emerald Valley Kitchen for 22 years, presently retired and working in position of consulting. And I am... and our company is in support of Senate Measure 570. We are manufacturers of ready-to-eat natural organic foods around this area for many years, and we sell our products all around the country. And the points that I want to talk about is the area of... We pride ourselves on integrity of products that we make. And the issue that of greatest concern for me and our company and companies that I've spoken with is about food safety. Ever since 9/11, the food manufacturers have had to contend with continual increases for maintaining food security, even though it's not required yet on a federal level. Most manufacturers, in order to be selling their products to Costco, Sam's Club, has to be required to use a HACCP plan, which is a hazard analysis critical control points. And basically it's a tracking system which is transparent for business, for the employees to track the original sources of your materials and to be able to determine where all the sources are that go into the final product. So if there is a need for a recall, we're able to get a recall, and we need to be shooting for 98 to close to 100% reliability to know where every product is if there's any kind of adverse impact of that particular product for the consumer. And when I look at the way the systems are set up right now for biopharm products, it's totally antithetical to the systems that are being required for our industry. And I'll start out with one is within the biopharm industry right now, the USDA is the only one who knows where those crops are going to be. So there's a veil of secrecy. And so a farmer who is growing whatever that crop might be could be adjoined relatively close, and their products could be impacted by pollens, cross-contamination, transportation, and movement of products through the agricultural system. The other thing is containment is a huge one for us in the area of food manufacturing. We do organics. We have to separate organic from not organic, big that are in steel canisters. We still have to separate it out. You're dealing with an open system if you allow biofarming to be used for in open field testing. And the other one is as we've heard before, the sciences are challenging on both sides, but one thing is, I think we can all agree, is just the unknown health effects of what these crops would be if they cross-contaminated into the regular food system. And a big concern that I, as a manufacturer and other manufacturers have, is around the area of liability, which is huge. I mean, we pay tons of money to maintain product liability. And as far as I know, and I haven't heard yet, that a lot of these biotech farms can't get liability for their product. An example was what happened with Protegene. And I think it was in Nebraska. They had contamination of the fields, and they had to go to the USDA to get low interest loans in order to pay for the losses. And a lot of the losses that happened from Starlink over a 17 state area, from the manufacturer down to the farmer to the grain elevators, they didn't get their full return of the billions of dollars that were lost, and it cost the government anywhere between $10 and $12 million just to do a search and seizure of these products, and they're still out there in the ecosystem.
Mr. Bancroft, do you have written testimony?
No, I don't.
Okay. No, I don't. That's all right. Go ahead.
And so as we gear up for greater levels of controls within the food industry for maintaining safety, it seems to be totally in opposition to maintaining those high standards within the food industry and not have a comparative standard that's as high or higher for something that is unknown for what its impact could possibly be if there is some contamination. And ultimately, at the end of the day, if a contamination happened and we source products from Oregon, so we're using Oregon products. We know there are no products out there now, but we're concerned where the future might go, is that the consumer is not going to remember Protegene. They're not going to remember Centex. They're going to remember Bob's Red Mill. They're going to remember Emerald Valley Kitchen. They're going to remember Golden Temple. They're going to remember all the other companies. And if there is a contamination and we have to do a recall, we're going to have to rebuild consumer confidence in our products. It happened before with Taco Bell in the Midwest, with a lot of their products that got contaminated. And I think the beautiful thing about this bill is the fact that it doesn't cost state, the consumer, or business any money or time. And it gives the time needed for having the appropriate analysis done to make sure that these products are safe. I don't personally...
Just a couple more minutes, please.
Okay. I'm just about done. I'm personally not challenged by the idea of using biotechnology for creating pharmaceuticals, but they should be in contained areas. And I think that's addressed within the bill, and these are the reasons that we support having this bill get passed. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Mr. Rankoff. Are there questions from the committee? Okay, I really appreciate your testimony. Steve Strauss, are you here? And are there any more witnesses on this bill? Okay, well then, you'll conclude it, Mr. Strauss. OSU, we all had orange and black ties on.
I forgot.
On Wednesday.
Thank you very much, Chair Ringo. I want to also give you what I consider to be some science perspectives. I'm a professor at Oregon State. I also chair a program called Outreach and Resource Biotechnology, where the goal is to try to provide information that we think is accurate in detail and context for the public and for decision makers. So I don't represent OSU, but I am speaking on behalf of that program. We're neutral. We haven't taken a position on this bill. We just want to provide some information.
What's your area of expertise, Mr.
I'm a geneticist and a biotechnologist. So in contrast to the ecologist you heard, I have more of a gene-oriented kind of a scientific perspective.
Thank you. And for the record, I need your name and the microphone.
Oh, did I not say that? Steve Strauss.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So what I'd like to do is that you have a three-page single-spaced kind of outline of what we see as sort of the science that informs this issue, and you've heard most of that already. We also have questions of interpretation of the bill. What is industrial? Does that include all agribusiness products that are processed in any way, or does it not? As I read the bill, that's not clear. So there's a lot of questions that I'm not going to dwell on right here. I'm mainly going to talk about the things I didn't hear talked about very much from a science perspective. And I guess the first thing is that why are people... I'll step back one moment and say I agree with the notions that this does not have large implications for Oregon in the near term. I think what's important about this bill is the message it sends, what it does to influencing research in the future in an academic setting and for companies, and whether it therefore closes opportunity costs for Oregon, both in terms of research and in terms of the large size of Oregon and its environmental diversity. There's lots of opportunities that could be utilized in the future for these kinds of crops, and they're very hard to predict. Anyway, the key thing I have not heard much about is the benefits. Why are we doing this? Why are we doing this to these crops? And there are huge, huge benefits considered worldwide or nationally to growing these crops. Benefits to be able to produce medicines at much lower cost. I've heard some estimates as high as 100-fold cost reductions. The ability to produce medicines for rare diseases, things that companies with current technology will not take on because it's too expensive to set up plants to produce them. So you see a great diversity of products in the pipeline. You see products for major health benefits that would be extremely costly to try to implement, things like HIV vaccines, malaria vaccines, hepatitis vaccines, diarrheal vaccines, things of this sort that could have major benefits for humans, mainly through the cost reduction. There's also benefits to improve stability of some of the products that are produced, where they don't need to be frozen or refrigerated, but can be stored in effect in the plants or the plant parts, like the oil seeds, and improve safety in terms of producing products that are more pure. When we produce things in cell cultures, there are often contaminants of various sorts, viruses that are relevant to human health that would not be in these products produced from plants. So the benefits, I think, are very large from a humanitarian point of view. Whether we're going to be doing them in Oregon or not is hard to say, but it seems to me this bill would probably foreclose a lot of that by sending a message that this is not a kind of thing we want to do in Oregon. Second point I want to make that I haven't heard said is kind of the ecological issue, the non-target effects. And it's hard to put that in perspective. When we produce crops with new proteins, new genes in them, what are they going to do in the ecosystem? And I just have to point out, in Oregon, we grow a very large number of exotic plants that produce large numbers of exotic chemicals that are, in effect, many of them poisons to organisms that haven't adapted to deal with them. So we do this all the time. We do it on a routine basis. The nursery industry in our state is the biggest agricultural industry. It produces and grows a lot of these kinds of crops. So it's not as though some of these non-target effects are not familiar. They are. And in many ways, those are larger because they involve many, many, many more genes because we're dealing with distinct species rather than single genes. Third point I would make is that from a science point of view, diversity is the key thing. It's hard to generalize about these classes of crops in terms of the toxicity, in terms of what kinds of species they're going to be grown in terms of where they're going to be grown, in terms of how they're going to be contained. One particular issue that I didn't hear talked about is that this bill would not allow these to be done in non-food crops. And for those who are concerned about this, one of the issues you see discussed in the science is why don't we try to do this more in non-food crops rather than in food crops where there's a serious risk of contamination. And that would not be possible under this bill as currently written. So the diversity of proteins means that very different concentrations will have very different kinds of health or ecological effects. It's really impossible to generalize. Many of these proteins, if they are ingested, if they get into food, would be broken down in the gut. They may be active if injected as a medicine, but they may be simply broken down in the gut and not be active. So it's very hard to make a generality about them. So that's one thing that is difficult about this bill. It tries to throw all of these things into one category and basically say we aren't going to do this for a long time. The definition of industrial concerned me. Would this include all processed agricultural products? So there's work underway to make allergen-reduced kinds of food products, enhanced protein food products, improved oils for oil production, increased interest in bio-based crops through genetic engineering of various kinds. Would they be precluded? I think that they might be. And I guess the last thing I'll just say is that I think contamination, we have to assume some level will happen. Of course, these crops are not going to be grown like normal crops, but some level will happen. But that's also true of agriculture as we know it. There's some level of contamination, but we deal with it. We pass laws about it, and we try to make sure that the levels of exposure don't exceed that. Thank you very much.
I really appreciate your testimony. Questions from the committee? Okay. Dr. Sprouse, thank you very much. I'm going to close the public hearing, and I want to recess the committee for about 5 minutes, and then we'll work on the last three bills. Just a 5-minute recess. Not much of a committee right now, but we'll get started anyway. We're going to go ahead and open a public hearing on Senate Bill 869, Senator Starr. John, would you like to come up as well? And Art, all three.
Thank you.
What are we on?
869. Thank you. For the record, State Senator Bruce Starr, Senate District 15, representing Western Washington County, the communities of North Plains, Cornelius, Forest Grove, and Hillsborough. Appreciate the opportunity to testify on Senate Bill 869 this morning. Mr. Chair, I think that this will be relatively painless and brief. And let me just talk real quickly about why 869 got introduced and what we're trying to accomplish, and then I'll turn it over to my friends here to talk about their perspective on this. And before the session started, I had some conversations with some folks in Washington County dealing with their frustrations on the development building process. Primarily, it's trying to work their projects through local governments, cities and counties. And the situation, as it was explained to me, is that, you know, these counties and cities go through a fairly lengthy and public process to develop, you know, a code around which the development community knows what the rules are, what the ground rules are as they move forward on a development in a particular jurisdiction. My conversations with members of this community, though, the development community, is that sometimes they're in the process and they'll have to deal with a planner or a government official that, let's just say, has a unique interpretation of what the words are in a particular code. And it's extremely frustrating for the development community not knowing what the real ground rules are. So we attempted to create a process here that would level the playing field to a certain extent and allow for the development community to have another option. And the other option would be that there would be basically an independent list of planners that the development community could go to get their plan stamped off on, who would read the local jurisdiction's code and enforce it the way that it was written, rather than have, let's just say, interesting interpretations of what the words say. My friends in the cities and counties, and rightly so, have concerns about the bill, and actually, Mr. Chandler, representing the development committee, isn't sure that the bill would work in its current form either. And I'm not sure that it's perfect. In fact, I know it's not. But I think that the issue is real, and it's one that we ought to, as a legislative body, get our hands around. And if there's ways that we can deal with this statutorily, I think I'd like to take the opportunity to work on this in a more thoughtful and deliberative time frame during the interim. But there are very real issues here when you have developments that take a year to get through the process just to get the approval, and the money that's tied up, the costs that are tied up. It's a very real problem, and one that I think we need to address. So with that, Mr. Chair, I appreciate the opportunity to have a hearing on Senate Bill 869. And, you know, if I don't know that we have to necessarily pass a bill to put together a task force to study this, I think we can do it in a more ad hoc fashion rather than, you know, necessarily pass a bill. I'd welcome the opportunity, if you wouldn't mind, hearing from my two compadres here. There might be somebody from the cities. Linda Legwood, I think, was waiting to testify. Okay. But I think it's an issue that it's helpful to shine a little light on, and something that we ought to work on when we have a little bit more time and can be more deliberative.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I've had conversations with folks about essentially getting the same issue, whether we need some sort of code of ethics for planners or some sort of oversight board, so that there's some consequence for arbitrary and irrational decisions, and this is getting to the same point. I mean, and the way you have the bill drafted is it directs counties to do things, or the governing bodies to do things. I guess I might have thought, well, on a statewide basis is how we need to handle it. But I appreciate your testimony, because I think that you raised an issue that's right on target. Is there questions for Senator Starr? Okay. Go ahead. Mr. Chandler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, on Senate Bill 869. We very much appreciate Senator Starr bringing this bill forward and you giving us a hearing, Mr. Chairman. This is a real problem. The discussion during the interim, I hope, can focus on, by backing up a second, it's a problem that's been on the table in other contexts. For example, in the yard last session, we talked in the context of industrial development about having some way of getting around the same problem that exists at the state level with state permitting, where interpretations can vary from individual to individual. Major projects can get stalled basically at the whim of those individuals, and some way of getting outside the process, not outside the rules, not outside the law, but to have a different body look at the same set of laws and give a different answer. What this bill is attempting to get to is exactly that at the local level. We in the development community refer to these interpretations as dream ups, things that aren't in the code, they aren't written down, development conditions and exactions and requests that are made of a developer while they're in the process with money invested on the table and the interest clock ticking. We used to write an article in our newsletter periodically about every year, actually, actually that would tell our members, if you say yes, it's legal. Because what often happens is things are requested, interpretations made that aren't in the code, but the developer goes along with it, frankly, because they can't afford not to. And again, as Senator Starr indicated, nothing in this bill or any of our discussions would indicate that the rules ought to change necessarily, but simply have a different way of interpreting them, a more consistent way of interpreting them, so that we know what the game is going in, we can budget for it, we can accommodate it, we can make whatever changes to the plans that are necessary, because these dream ups tend to occur late in the process. And that drives us absolutely nuts. If we know early that we have to do things in a certain way, it's much easier to accommodate, much less expensive. With that, I'll close. We will certainly be part of any interim conversation. This is an issue that I think ought to be easy to fix, but it's one that if we don't get our hands around the cost of development and the obvious impact on both housing prices and economic development, will continue to increase. I'd be glad to take any questions.
Thank you very much. Senator Barr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chandler, we seem to be developing new terms this session. We heard upskirt yesterday in judiciary. Now I just heard one for a dream up.
A dream up.
Are these new technical terms?
And do you have videos of dream up?
Well, I'm not sure what an upskirt is. I'm not sure I want to be involved in the same paragraph. It's all the same to you, Senator Beyer. Never mind. I'll now show my maturity by choking back the obvious one-liners that came to mind. Dream up is a term of art. It comes from the Latin dreamus upus.
Art, why don't you straighten this out, please?
Chair, can I add to this comedy, or should I just be serious for a minute? I think I'd rather be serious. And yeah. I had some dreams as John was talking, and I'm not sure that any of you would want to go there with me. But in any case, Mr. Chair, Art Slack with the Association of Oregon Counties, and here to speak to Senate Bill 869. We've had a conversation with Senator Starr. We are beginning to understand the issue which he is has raised and is interested in addressing. We are very much concerned with the bill as drafted. We understand some of the issues that he has and are committed at this point to work with him and others during the interim to hopefully address that issue. Let me just say that whatever response or to the issues that we develop, we need to be able to do it in a manner that can be implemented across the state of Oregon, and that the way the bill is drafted right now, I'm not sure that it provides the same opportunities in eastern and maybe in some counties in southern Oregon as it might in the valley where you have more people. I can visualize in eastern Oregon County where there may be only one or two planners, and we're talking about creating a registry. And you're either going to get planners from the valley being on a registry in eastern Oregon, which is going to create problems and issues because they're not familiar with the application there, or you're going to wind up with the same person who's on the registry who's done an application reviewing the application, and that doesn't bode well either. So there are some problems here with the bill as drafted, and I made the commitment to Senator Starr that we'll work with him during the interim.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Just to reiterate, I've been interested in this issue as well, and I think it does need looking at. So thank you very much. Let's close the public hearing. We were going to have a public hearing or a work session on Senate Bill 529, but I mean we tried to do that a couple minutes ago, and Senator Burdick wasn't here. On 529, we opened that public work session. Remember, Senator Beyer?
Yeah, and there was nobody else here, so we didn't do anything.
Let's open a work session on Senate Bill 529. Senator Burdick, is there a motion?
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 529 to the Ways and Means Committee by prior referral with no recommendation.
Senator Burdick has moved Senate Bill 529 to Ways and Means with no recommendation. Is there any discussion? Is there any objection? So ordered.
Where's
the sign-up sheet?
Mr. Chair. While we're pausing, I would move to suspend the rules to allow Senator Burdick to vote on Senate Bill 389.
Thank you. We'll reopen a work session on Senate Bill 389. Senator Beyer has moved that we suspend the rules to open a work session to allow Senator Beyer to vote on Senator Burdick to vote on Senate Bill 389. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. The work session is now reopened on Senate Bill 389. Senator Burdick, do you wish to vote on Senate Bill 389?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate Senator Beyer allowing the suspension of the rules. I would like to vote yes on Senate Bill 389.
Okay, so Senator Burdick votes aye on Senate Bill 389, and that closes the work session on Senate Bill 389. All right, let's open the work session on Senate Bill 245. If you three want to come up and just inform us very briefly on Senate Bill 245, that would be great.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Randy Tucker, Legislative Affairs Manager for Metro. I'm just here just in case. We've got our Metro Councilor Rod Park to testify, and in addition to Mr. Chandler, as well as our Senior Deputy Counsel, did I get that right? Dick Benner, who's only here to answer questions if you have any questions. So, thanks.
Go ahead.
Okay, Senator Ringo, Mr. Chair, thank you for this little bit of time that we have. I'll try to be brief. As you know, I'm a Metro Councilor from the district up on the east side of the region up.
And your name is?
Rod Park.
Thank you.
I'm sorry. As Randy said when he testified on this bill a couple of weeks ago, that Metro has brought Senate Bill 245 ahead for two related issues. The first is that Metro, as you know, is the only jurisdiction that's required to move the boundary every 5 years. And this exercise, though sometimes amusing to some, is extremely costly and time-consuming. Not only in both money, but and more, maybe more importantly, in citizen goodwill. And I think I can state fairly clearly that we are suffering from UGB fatigue in the region. It also diverts Metro's resources from its ability to find ways to make the land ready for development that has been brought inside the urban growth boundary. It prevents Metro and its local partners from undertaking the long-range planning activities necessary to make the regions livable and economically competitive. Second, over time, as we've complied with the five-year requirement, it has become increasingly clear the problem isn't the lack of land. It's getting the land that's already within the boundary developed. Something I was trying to point out earlier when we started this exercise several years ago, but apparently now it's more since it's more real to some people. For example, the 20,000 acres that we've bought in the last two cycles of 2002 and 2004, I really can't testify that any of that land has resulted in any new jobs or any new houses. On those particular lands. I suspect there's a lot of consultants that are making a pretty good amount of change, though. Senate Bill 245 is aimed at addressing both of these problems, and let me walk you through three substantial elements of the Dash 1 amendments. First, the amendments give Metro a one-time, two-year extension on the deadline for completion of analysis to our urban growth boundary. This would be taking it from 2007 to 2009. I would contrast this with the old bill that was originally introduced, which would permanently extend the cycle from 5 to 10 years. The amendment represents an extremely modest request, we feel, that will allow Metro to focus on developing and addressing the 20,000 acres, as I mentioned earlier, that were brought into the boundary since 2002. Second, the Dash 1 amendment includes language intended to jumpstart the process of planning for the development of areas added to the urban growth boundary. The amendments include a deadline for completion of planning and a series of actions to be taken if those deadlines are not met. Should note that those deadlines, tight deadlines, are at the request of our members of the Portland region, the community, the Metro Policy Advisory Committee. 3rd, at the request of the region's development community, the draft includes provisions to address any loss of development capacity from the adoption of cities or counties to protect natural resources. This provision applies to capacity to accommodate both residential and employment uses. The amendments before you are the result of very productive discussions over the last couple of months with members of the region's development community. And actually, I should say it's been over the last couple of years because we were very close to some things last session. These discussions are continuing even today, and we expect some minor amendments to come forward, but we are unaware of any opposition to this bill moving out of this committee today with a do-pass recommendation. I'd like to thank you for the time and for your efforts on behalf of the region and the citizens, and be happy to answer any questions.
Okay, thank you very much. Other questions? Okay.
We'll wait until the
thank you. Chandler?
Senator, thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. John Chandler, Oregon Home Builders Association, here on behalf of Senate Bill 245. We would agree with Councilor Park. This bill should get a do-pass recommendation from this committee. We hope you will do that. We've been working very closely with Metro in trying to address the problems that Councilor Park identified. In particular, our concern is that as we move boundaries, that simple paper exercise of an arbitrary line on a map doesn't do much of anything unless the planning gets done so we know what goes where, and the infrastructure money is available to actually build the water pipes, the sewer plants, and the roads. This bill can't do anything about the infrastructure piece other than that as it gets planned, but the holdup in the expansion areas that Metro did just recently has primarily been one of planning. We can't get the plans done so people know where to put their investments, where to start the building. And that is absolutely nuts. This bill addresses that problem. We believe also that it gives Metro an important set of tools working with their local government partners in the region to make sure that we don't, frankly, from the development community side, we don't much care who does the plan, if it's a city or a county or Metro. We just want to make sure it happens, because otherwise the act of moving boundaries and all the political agony that that entails is worthless. And while, as Councilor Park said, it can be entertaining in a train wreck kind of way, but it is not productive unless something actually comes out the other end. We think, and we're continuing to talk, there may be, as Councilor Park said, a few minor amendments in the House, but this is a much improved bill than when it started. The five-year review was our idea in the first place. We think it's important to keep Metro focused on the task at hand, and while we don't want to keep them on the hamster wheel, I can't pass up the opportunity to point out that Metro itself installed a couple other hamster wheels as well that they got to run on. So, with that being said, we do encourage you to pass this bill out. I think it's going to help solve a very critical problem in the Portland metropolitan area and actually result in some of those 20,000 acres starting to develop houses and jobs and tax base for the region. Thank you very much. We're glad to take any questions.
Well, Mr. Chair, I don't know if Mr. Tucker was going to give us any more information or not, but he and I had a hallway conversation a couple days ago about the bill, and the question I have is we had another bill earlier in this committee that was dealing with the east versus west cities, basically, and that the western cities were upset that Metro was making them do something that they didn't want to do. And it seems like this bill will only make that problem worse, as in it directs Metro to do more of the local planning in areas, the way I read it, versus allowing that to be done by the city. So where currently we had Hillsborough and Forest Grove coming in, you know, on a different bill, we're now going to have all the cities, and I fear would be coming in saying, you know, wait, Metro's doing local planning, and they're only supposed to do regional planning. So I guess I'd like to have that concern addressed.
Sure, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, and Senator Beyer. The language that Senator Beyer is referring to is on page 2 of the amendment, lines 25 through 28, I believe. And I brought Mr. Benner here to specifically address this question because there are some different options around this language. So why don't I step away and let him come up.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, on the question of what happens if a local government is most likely going to be a city is given responsibility to plan one of these areas that comes into the boundary, and it refuses to do it for one reason or another. And we've had a few isolated incidents of that over the years. The system that works today, that's in place today, under our charter and under ORS Chapter 268, says that Metro can put standards in place for that area, that territory coming in. And that's essentially what the language that was added to this bill as a result of our discussions that you've heard about today on lines 25 to 28. And you were referring to east-west discussions, regional, local discussions, probably in conjunction with Senate Bill 730 and perhaps others over the last couple of months. And this particular authority that I'm referring to, and that is included in sub D on page 2, there hasn't been an argument about that with some folks on the west side who have had their complaints about other exercise of authority by Metro. They're not here today, and of course it would be best if they told you that themselves as opposed to me telling you that, but you do know that they're not here today. City of Hillsborough in particular has not had a concern with that enforcement authority that we're talking about here that's in our charter and in ORS Chapter 268. That's where this language comes from.
So, Mr. Chair, I guess just for clarity, I guess the City of Hillsborough and others know about these amendments and had a chance to review them.
Well, that may be a question for Mr. Tucker. I'm not sure.
I just want to interject here. We didn't get these amendments until this morning, and frankly, they contain things that I did not know would be in these amendments, and that makes me uncomfortable with moving the bill right now. And so what I'd like to do is just hold off on moving the bill. We've got one other bill on our schedule today. So I'm going to go ahead and close the work session on this and or at least roll it over till next week. I'll roll it over till next week. But I'd like to work more with you folks on this bill, satisfy Senator Beyer on his concerns. So that's what I'd like to do on this bill. So we're going to close the work session on Senate Bill 245. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 347. If we could have Dave Leland and Willie Tiffany from League of Oregon Cities.
Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Ringo and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dave Leland, and I manage the Safe Drinking Water Program for the Department of Human Services. And I'm here today to testify in support of Senate Bill 347 and also the Dash 1 amendment that you have before you. I have some written testimony coming around, but I think I would just like to make just 3 points this morning. First of all, what's the problem here that is attempting to be solved by this bill? This goes back to a Secretary of State audit of our program back in 2001. And in that audit, the Secretary of State found that the department didn't always receive all the required public water system test results. The audit also concluded that water suppliers could, in effect, decide which tests the department gets and when they get them. And really, it was, and while the Secretary of State auditors did find some test results in some lab files that we didn't receive that they thought we should have, they were really, I think, concerned on a broader level about what does this mean in terms of the effectiveness of state oversight of drinking water in Oregon. So the Secretary of State report recommended a legislative change to require labs to report to both the department and the water systems simultaneously. And this issue has come up a couple of times before the legislature since then. This time, we participated in a stakeholder group to develop some kind of look and see what kind of agreeable amendment could be made to this to reach some agreement among all the stakeholders, which you have before you. And the department does agree with this amendment. And what it does is require limited direct lab reporting and limits it just to reporting the compliance test results that are in excess of some established standard.
So that specifically doesn't apply to tests. I mean, I'll put it this way. It applies to compliance tests. Doesn't apply to, say, system tests. Is that how do you
correct,
put it?
Chair. Yeah, that's correct, Chair. Okay. Right, yeah. So it's the compliance reports, the compliance tests are the ones that our rules require to be submitted by the water supplier. And then, again, also just limiting that to those test reports that show a level of contaminant in excess of one of our established standards. And I'll tell you that really, out of all the test reports, we get thousands and thousands of test reports, and really very few of them show levels of contaminants above limits. So we believe that the Dash 1 amendments really do address the central concern of the Secretary of State's audit report, which is that the positive tests ultimately do get to our attention so we can assist water suppliers with any problems there might be there. So we do support the Dash 1 amendments. And got to tell you, Not everybody's going to support the Dash 1 amendments, and you'll have some folks here today that have some concerns about that. So I think I will conclude, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much. Mr. Tiffany?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities, and Dave has done a real good job in terms of the background. As you know, this has been a controversial issue for my membership, but early this session when this bill was introduced, we did have an opportunity to come to you and ask if we could sit down and try to reach some sort of agreement, because I believe, I did at that time and still do today, that if we made some subtle changes, we could preserve the concept of direct reporting in a way that we could support. And I think the Dash 1 amendments almost do that. We have one minor change that we need to have, but basically the intent here is the same intent that came out of that work group. That work group included large and small municipalities and the labs and the department. I think the labs, I'll let them speak for themselves, are not in agreement with the Dash 1 amendments, but they can talk about those issues.
So the work group included the large and small municipalities.
Mm-hmm.
Who else?
The department.
Department and the labs.
Some selected labs to represent
okay.
the labs generally. And I think those representatives all are here today. We'll be able to talk to you
okay.
About that. So I can speak on behalf of all the municipalities. The districts are not here, but they also do agree with these amendments.
Okay.
The one change, Mr. Chair, is on line 16. Do you just want to put that on the record?
Sure.
That in line 16, before results, we'd like to add the term validated. And really, that's a term of art. Dave can talk about the NELAP program. I can't tell you what NELAP stands for, but it's a national certified program that Oregon has just entered into. And I think that's going to go a long ways for my members in helping with the quality control and quality assurance of the lab testing program to make sure that those results, when they're directly reported to the department as well as to us, that they are accurate results. And that's really what was our main issue.
And so define a little bit more of what you think the word validated means.
The labs can speak to it directly, or Dave can, but my understanding is in the nationally certified program, a validated result has to go through a number of quality assurance and quality control measures to make sure that that result or that sample is accurate to what the lab is testing for. I don't know, Dave, if you want to add anything to that.
Chair Ringo and members of the committee, I think here's how I would put it, and you'll hear from the labs too, but we just wanted to be clear that we weren't asking for results of lab tests that weren't completed yet. We want to make sure that the lab test has been through all of the quality assurance procedures that are required to the end point where that sample result is signed off by the lab and all those processes have been completed.
To me, the word validated means that it's been double-checked. For example, let's say that you've got a result that shows a failure, that then somebody would double-check that. That's different than being a completed test.
Chair Ringo, I think that's a fairly good way to look at it. That is just, and these procedures, the checking procedures, are all defined. They're defined in the laboratory manual of the checks that are to be completed to make sure that that final result is valid.
Mr. Chair, I'd just add that it's the same result that the municipality would receive.
Yeah.
So we're not talking about different results. The validated result is that's the same report that the municipality would receive. So at the same point of time, a report would go off to the department if it had a positive sample, as it would to the municipality.
I see. Senator Byron.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Willie, who do the labs work for?
The labs work for private industries as well as municipalities.
Okay, but in this case, they're working for the cities, right?
Or
the
water. Many cities, some cities have internal labs, some of the larger cities that do these results, but many municipalities contract with private labs to do these tests, yes.
Well, I'm confused why we would ask an independent third party that's working for a municipality or a city or a private water district, whatever the case might be, to send the results somewhere else. What's wrong with the system of having the municipality send the non-conforming results to the department?
Well, my response, Senator Byron, and this is based on the bill that I introduced, I can't remember the last session, the session four, is because there's been at least one example where they just didn't. And that raised health issues, and the idea was that the cost of mailing a report, as long as you're sending it to one place, it costs a stamp to mail it somewhere else, and if it puts more certainty into the system that you're going to catch a problem if there is going to be a positive test result, it builds that additional certainty at virtually no expense.
Well, I guess I would argue if there's someone who wasn't following the law, because I think the law said that the cities and the municipalities were already supposed to submit the report, if someone wasn't following the law, why don't we deal with the lawbreaker rather than require a third party individual who works for the persons. I mean, that's like asking your doctor to send your report to your dentist because he doesn't know, or vice versa, because because they don't trust you to do it yourself.
Well,
even though, so, and that's just where I'm coming from.
Okay, that's fine. Appreciate that. Go ahead. Are you finished?
I think the issue has been articulated, and we're trying to hopefully reach a compromise with the -1.5 amendments if we can get that issue.
Thank you. Senator Burdick, any questions?
Thank you, Senator Chair. Mr. Chair. I was just wondering, you talked about the Secretary of State's audit, and that's what created this. Did they specifically direct you into this approach of having the, in some cases, third party person send it to Department of Human Services?
Chair Ringo, Senator Burdick, yes, the audit report has a specific recommendation to the legislature contained in the report. And the reason it's a recommendation to the legislature and not to the department is because the department does not have authority under existing law to require laboratories to report directly to the department.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you. Thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Let's hear the flip side of this. John Nielsen, is it Keith Chapman and Beth Myers?
Good morning again, Senator Ringo. How are you? Good morning,
yeah.
Senator.
And
Yeah, Mr. Nielsen, welcome to Salem. And I met with Mr. Nielsen a couple months ago. He was very gracious and came all the way up to talk to me about this. So thanks for coming again.
Thank you for the opportunity to speak before the committee this morning. My name is John Nielsen. I'm the past president and founder of the Oregon Environmental Laboratory Association, which we started almost 20 years ago to get laboratories certified within the state of Oregon. I'm also a board member on the Drinking Water Advisory Committee to the Drinking Water section of the Department of Human Services. I'm also a board member on the Oregon Technical Advisory Committee, which is a committee which advises the NELAC certification process in Oregon for certified laboratories. I own and operate Nielsen Research Corporation, which is a private environmental testing laboratory. It's been testing water for 24 years in the state of Oregon. Representing the Oregon Environmental Laboratory Association, Senate Bill 347 directly removes, because of the way that the bill has been written, directly removes the responsibility of reporting from the public water system, who is producing the water and giving it to the population, and places that responsibility directly on the laboratories. And I, you know, we don't believe that the laboratory should be the policeman here. Granted, the concept of the Secretary of State audit report, which came out and said, you know, we have failure of direct reporting and failure of reporting by public water systems, and if we can get the laboratories to direct report, and when you read the Secretary of State's audit reports, which I have five copies here if you'd like, the concept sounds good. But the concept is flawed because the Senate bill removes the responsibility of the public water system to report and lays it directly on the back of the private lab and municipal laboratories. If there was some compromise at some point where it didn't remove the responsibilities from the public or from the public water systems, and the laboratories reported in addition to, that might be something that the organization could work through. But don't put all the responsibility on our shoulders, please.
Well,
thank you.
Excuse me. No. I appreciate your testimony, Mr. Nielsen, and I think you raise a good point. And maybe after you're done, we'll bring the cities back up and ask them. My goal is to try to ensure safety in drinking water. Mm-hmm. And to me, to have a dual reporting of a top positive result doesn't hurt anything. Can you see any harm in having a report of a positive coming from two different directions?
Yes and no. DHS, Department of Human Services, doesn't have the manpower. I have talked with the drinking water section. I have spoken with Dave Weaveland on this issue over numerous times. They don't have the manpower, and they don't have the funds to enforce a lot of the stuff that currently is in there right now. Okay? They're short on funding and they're short on personnel. If we enact this bill and all the labs send in the reports, is drinking water going to be any safer in Oregon? Absolutely not. Because their people can't get through the paperwork fast enough to figure out what's going on.
Well, even if you report the positive reports, how many?
All the reports, because in the Senate bill, everything goes in. So now they've got to sort out the positives from the negatives.
Now, you're referring to the -1 amendments?
No, I'm talking about the original.
Okay.
The original proposal.
We need to focus on the -1 amendments. So,
well, both of them are up for consideration, I assumed.
Well.
Maybe not.
Mr. Nielsen, I haven't been involved in the work group.
Okay.
I assume that the -1 amendments are a step in the right direction, and maybe it's what we need to do is have a further work group on this. I would like to hear your comments, and I guess I'm directing this at all three of you, at the -1 amendments.
Well, the -1 amendments is reporting just the contaminated samples only and then sending the results to the public water systems and allowing them to send in basically the negative samples. Okay, that's a tremendous burden on the laboratory because now we have to sort through every lab sample which comes out and have to figure out, this one's positive or this one's negative. There's also a 24-hour reporting requirement that's in this bill and that's part of it. And in the Secretary of State's audit report on page 5, It says, if the analysis indicates the presence of coliform bacteria or if any other contaminants are exceeded, the results must be reported to the division within 24 hours or the next business day. Now, as soon as the laboratories get these results, we pick up the phone and we call the public water system. Okay? Sometimes these are not validated results.
Can I ask you?
These are completed results, but they're not validated.
But they suggested adding the word validated.
Right.
How many positive validated results does your lab find in, I don't know, a week, a month, a year? How often does that happen?
Well, let's see. We're doing, 500 bacteriological samples alone a month. So what's that, 6,000? Samples. Some of these are public water systems. Some of them are private. They all go. They all get processed through.
But how many are there positive validated results?
How many are positive validated? You know, I honestly can't give you a specific number because it varies. Because some of those positive validated results are from John Q. homeowners' private wells that are being processed. We don't do just city drinking water. We do, you know, private drinking water as well. So we have to go through and sort all those out. And we do this, and as soon as we come across one that's positive for a public water system, a mobile home park, let's say, my staff on Saturday, on Sunday, we're on the phone to that public water system immediately notifying them of the results. So they're going to be notified, let's say, Saturday night. My quality assurance officer may not validate that result till Wednesday.
But then why couldn't you just, once it's validated, just send it off to Department of Human Services?
Once it's validated, send it off? Yeah. Right. But see, you're going to put the responsibility of reporting onto me.
You've already taken the responsibility. You've made the phone call.
Yes, I made the phone call. And that's part of what we have to do.
Special pile. Why couldn't you just then make a copy of it and mail it off?
We will make a copy.
You separated it.
But the public water system currently right now has got that responsibility to notify DHS also. We're reporting to the public water system. The public water system has the responsibility of reporting to DHS.
Mr. Chair, do you have, when you work for a public water system, is there a contract?
No. They can go any place they want to go. Hopefully, if we provide good service, they come back.
But, I mean, they don't set up a contract to pay you? And, you know, you'll do this, and then we pay you that, and set up terms of the contract?
No, ma'am, just like you don't have a contract with Walmart. We're a private company, and you bring your sample in, and we test it. And, but, they've, you know.
So there's at least an agreement that you'll test it, and then you'll get paid, right? You get paid for your
Any services that you do, but, you know.
Okay.
You know. You don't sign a contract when you go see your physician.
Well, I don't know about that.
Well,
often you do, but go ahead. I mean, Mr. Nielsen, I want to hear the rest of your testimony, but I guess I really want to be focused on the -1 amendments and really understand why this is an impediment, you know, rather than raising the worst case scenarios, whether it can't be made workable. The major
complaint of all the laboratories, and particularly in the private laboratories, is the liability issue that goes on the laboratories. The way this amendment is written, when it takes the responsibility off the public water system and puts it directly on the laboratory. If the laboratory, and we've had this happen where we do it now as a service to the client, and the client says, will you send our report to state? And we do that. Okay? And 2 weeks ago, I had a client in raking my secretary over the coals because he got a noncompliance letter from DHS, and we were directly supposed to put it in. Well, we had sent it in. We had a copy. We had documentation that we sent it in, but DHS somehow didn't get it. But my secretary took the brunt of that, and I don't particularly appreciate it. And my client, we finally got it all settled out. We got on the phone and we did all these things, but that is just a typical example. You know, it's my responsibility. So if the laboratory does the reporting, who gets the violation? Does the violation go to the laboratory or does the violation go to the public water system for not getting it in on time? And there's also a requirement that water tests are supposed to be in by the 10th of the month. So if the client brings it in to me, a long complex test, let's say that takes 3 weeks, and he brings it in to me on December the 31st, and it takes 3 weeks for me as a laboratory to process it out, I can't make that 10th of the month compliance date. Therefore, now I'm at fault, because the client brought it in on December the 31st, so I get the violation?
Okay. I don't think that that's one of our amendments are crafted with that in mind. But look.
The Dash One Amendment, the concept of the Dash One Amendment.
I wasn't commenting on that. Oh. But I don't disagree with what he's saying. You shift burden of responsibility, you also shift liability of the burden.
It's the liability. That's the 99.9% objection to this bill.
99.9% is objection, okay.
Is liability. You know, I mean, there's the rest of this is zig things, but we took out the words that the public water system has got the responsibility to report.
Well, I think that's in the Dash One Amendments. We'll hear from those folks later, but why don't we go ahead, Beth Myers? Water Lab Corporation, where are you based out of?
I'm based here in Salem.
Okay.
My name is Beth Myers.
Thanks for coming this morning.
Thank you. I did submit some written testimony, and most of it was based toward the main amendment. But I would like to follow through on what John's saying, and that we all pay liability insurance, and most of ours is through Lloyd's of London, and that's going to go up because I talked to them if we become liable for the results to go in. So that increases the cost for all testing because it isn't just municipal people that do testing. It's also private well owners that are Oregonians that have testing. And every time the cost goes up, then they can't afford the testing either.
Well, okay. Go ahead.
So while this bill is addressed to municipalities and public water systems, it will impact the well owners in the state also. I won't go through all my testimony, but my big problem with this bill is that it's based on false information in the state and the Secretary of State's audit, because I was the lab that had the report that didn't go in. And they totally misunderstood what that was and didn't ask me any questions, and then it comes out in this report. So my feeling is they didn't understand what the sample was and based this whole huge argument on a false premise. So how many false premises are we going to spend money on here in the state? I don't understand what the problem is and what this problem will solve. Even the Dash One Amendment, what problem will it solve is what we're all asking. And if you look at the Secretary of State Audit's report, it also said that there needed to be another electronic data program for the health division to be able to handle this. So if you're not going to give them what they need to handle it, you're not going to achieve anything anyway. My office calls, as John's does, probably, we call the data center probably two or three times a day, a lot of times during the week. And the data isn't up on the web yet, or like John said, it's been lost, or, you know, it's not their fault. They just have enormous amounts of paper to get through. So what will this solve, even just faxing in or sending in a bad report? Because the water system's already on it, and I've been in business since 1979. I just don't see that this is a problem for the water systems. I don't see where Oregon's drinking water is going to be any safer with this than not, and yet we will spend an inordinate amount of money because it will take more staff for me, and I'm pretty bare bones right now. I mean, the economy's got me pretty well down. Between the economy and the NELAC lab certification, my costs, as John's have skyrocketed.
Can I just ask a couple questions, please? How would you, under this bill, let's say it were passed, that's one of them, how would you transmit the report to DHS? Would it be electronically? Would it be mail? How would it get there?
My guess is we'd do maybe fax if we could get through the fax lines. Yeah. We already transmit electronically, but we only do that once a month.
And how many validated positives for, let's not use well water, the public drinking water?
Compliant validated samples.
How often does that happen?
Not very often. So what's the problem?
Well, but my question is your costs. I mean, that's what I'm interested in, is your additional costs. This is what I'm trying to understand, and maybe I'm dismissing it, but here you look at a report. It's validated. It's completed. It's for a public water system. You're going to be faxing it to the municipality. What's the extra expense in punching in the number to fax it to DHS?
Well, if you've ever had to fax very many reports.
But I asked you how many.
Probably, I'm guessing maybe five a month would be a lot.
And that's the expense you're concerned about, five a month.
Well, why are we worried then about whether it goes in?
Well, ma'am, that's a different issue. It's one question as to whether there's a problem. Okay, and I agree that's worth discussing. Let's discuss that. But the other thing you raised is it'll raise your costs a lot.
That's what I'm talking about
If we have to do all of them, but we're talking about doing less, right?
Well, you, the apparently for you, it's about five a month.
Right.
And so what are your costs in sending five faxes a month?
It wouldn't be a whole lot. It could be doable, but what would it be the point of getting it there?
The problem is when you tell this committee things like that, oh, it'll raise your costs a lot. And now you say five faxes a month. It's hard for me to accept your testimony as credible.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I think the other issue that that she has pointed out, and I agree with, is the liability issue. The cost of the liability insurance, which raises costs.
Well, then let's talk about that, because I agree. That's an important issue to explore. But when she says she's going to have to hire more people to send five faxes a month,
sir,
it's hard for me to accept anything in her testimony. Yes, Mr. Nielsen.
We may have five problems also, but in the process of processing 600 samples a month going through the laboratory, I have to have a person going through those each and every day, sorting and making sure that we don't miss one. Okay? It's almost harder to report the positive because it's not just coliform bacteria. It's also chemical data, which is included in this. This is the chemical data from lead copper analysis. This is the chemical data from inorganic laboratory test results. This just isn't just looking at a bacteriological slip and submitting it, because this bill applies to all chemistry data. Okay? And this right here is an organic test report. Okay? And if there's one failure on here, I got to fax this whole thing, because this is the legal document. DHS only wants, you know, the page with the analysis on it. But under NELAC, this is the legal document. This is what has to go through. This is what has to be sent. So it's not just the cost of the five. It's the cost of the personnel to sort out the five, get it on the fax, to make sure that we have it up there and we meet the compliance and we do all that in a timely manner. Plus the liability.
Okay. Let's hear it from Mr. Chapman. You've been sitting there quietly. Thank you very much.
Well, I'm sitting quietly because I only have one or two points. My name is Keith Chapman. I've been responsible for the testing the drinking water that's provided by the City of Salem for 18 years. During that time, we've had, I think, two positive coliform tests. So,
two in 18 years.
In 18 years.
Okay.
So, and but at no time was there any. Was the system ever out of compliance? Because compliance is much more complicated than a single sample. And so I'll just confine my short comment to that, because anything else I have to say has already been said. And so to represent a municipal system, I believe the City of Salem is pretty neutral on the bill as it stands. I, as the lab director, am here to say that I am not for it because of two problem areas. The lab all of a sudden is responsible for determining which sample is for compliance and which is not for compliance for other reasons. That's an additional responsibility. And most importantly, just because a single sample exceeds a limit does not mean a system is out of compliance. Example. An example of trihalomethanes and haloacetic acids. These are what are called disinfection byproducts. There are limits of 80 and 60 parts per billion set by EPA. Single samples might exceed those, but compliance is determined on a running average of a number of samples. The lab may or may not know what the running averages are. It's the water system that's responsible for that compliance. So reporting a single sample that exceeds, I'm not sure what the point is there and what the water system would feel like it has. What the public health would feel like they have to do with that result. Second and last example, lead copper testing. These are not only you can have violations of a single sample, but here are samples that are beyond the control of the water system because they're taken at the customer's tap. You can have more than 15 parts per billion of lead. It's not unusual, but that's only one sample and taken under restricted circumstances. Compliance for the water system is typically on the basis of 50 to 100 samples. So if you send in that individual result, again, that doesn't mean the system's out of compliance. So these are areas, I think, that are beyond the scope of the Secretary of State's audit a couple of years ago. And so I just sort of offer that when you get into some of the details, water systems, laboratories are responsible, feel responsible for the safety of the people who drink the water that we test. We take this very seriously. And we are on the phone is the minute and sometimes before a sample is completed. If we see something going positive, we're on the phone. I work for the water system here in Salem. That's the way we work. I know who to phone, and any time of the week, we let them know. To let the public health department know for a couple of samples, because in a well-run water system, you have few, if any. Now, but not all water systems are like that. So for the city of Salem, this doesn't put a big burden on us. However, for the labs that we use, because we don't do all our own testing, I use labs in other states and in other parts of this state. And the chances for a non-compliant sample are higher when you're looking at extremely low levels of organic contaminants. That takes, again, it's beyond our control, and we put the responsibility for our water systems, the reporting, in the hands of someone else. And I can't speak for out-of-state labs, but I'm not sure what they feel like. And so there are some, the issue of compliance is that. So to say, and the only contaminant I can think of that makes sense to do this are coliform bacteria and E. coli. And we already report those to the water system just immediately.
But for coliform or E. coli, it would make sense to report them directly to DHS as well.
Only, and that's my opinion, in that case, I would do it. All the rest of this, it just gets too complicated.
Ms. Myers, Mr. Nielsen, what about that?
Just reporting the coliform bacteria, that might be something that the organization might want to consider. But when you get into all the rest of the chemistries, it just really becomes a nightmare. But again, it's the liability, and relieving the public water system of the responsibility to reporting them.
Well, I don't want to leave on that. Ms. Myers, what's your response to reporting just the coliform?
Well, I think the more we do for any kind of organization, the more they don't have to do. And so my water systems are more than happy to just not pay any attention to anything and let me do all the work. And so if you want the labs to take over more and more, that's the kind of attitude we have. They don't want to have to pay attention to their testing. They don't want to have to do all that, and they already blame us, like John was saying.
Wow.
So the more we do for them, the less they have to learn.
All right. Senator Beyer, any questions? I want to just follow up very briefly with the folks from the city and DHS, and we'll close this hearing. But thank you very much for coming here and testifying. Dave Lieberman, Willie Tiffany, just a couple follow-ups. What about the idea that this shifts responsibility so that the cities wouldn't do it, or the government entities wouldn't do it? I should say the water districts don't do it.
Well, Mr. Chair, again, for the record, Willie Tiffany at the League of Cities. This bill, and particularly the -1 amendments, does not remove any liability from the municipal water supplier. We are required under law to report these samples, and we are liable for the quality of water that served our citizens. Even if the labs do directly report, we are required still under law to report those positive samples. So DHS under this bill would receive two samples. I can't speak to the liability of if the labs themselves decline, if this bill was enacted, if they decline to directly report for some reason or another, I suppose they would be liable and the department would have some sort of an enforcement action. But in terms of
liable
not to us, to the department for failure to report, but not for the quality of the report. We are still, as the municipal water supplier, liable for the quality of water that is provided to our citizens.
Okay. Mr. Leland, there was a comment that DHS is too busy to look at these reports anyway, that you guys are flooded with information. I mean, What if you got a fax of a report that said there was E. coli? Would you put that in some in basket and look at it 2 weeks later? What would happen?
Chair Rigo, absolutely not. And in fact, one of the things we strive for all the time in processes in our office is to sort of find the needle in the haystack. And I think you heard earlier, Chair Rigo, that there aren't many test reports that show a level of contaminant possibly of concern to public health. There aren't many of those. So we've designed our in-house systems to make sure that those results are immediately identified so that we can have that opportunity. And you might ask, well, what did we do with them? Well, we're on the phone to that water supplier right now. And to find out, you know, A, do they know they have a positive sample? Usually they do. And are they doing the appropriate follow-up steps that are called for, you know, to find out if it's a real problem or not? And if it is, you know, we our goal is to help them figure it out and protect public health.
What about the testimony that said that one sample doesn't mean anything, that it's an average of 50 to 100 samples?
Well, that's absolutely right.
The point is...
That there are specific things that need to be done with many of the tests if there's a high result that, you know, are to follow up and confirm whether or not there's a problem. And so let me refer back to the Secretary of State's audit report for a second. You know, they found three results in their studies that they thought we should have received. And, yes, one was a bacteria result, but there was also a lead result and a nitrate result that we never received. And so while that's true, one sample doesn't put you over some regulatory limit, but that's really not the issue we're talking about here. The issue is there timely and appropriate follow-up to reports that indicate there might be a problem, to rapidly determine if there is or if there isn't, and if there is, to get it corrected and protect people's health.
So, from your perspective, if we narrowed this to just require the direct reporting of E. coli and I was going to say chloroform. What is it?
Bacteria.
Yeah.
Coliform.
Thank you very much, Senator Beyer. That would probably be too narrow, because things such as lead, nitrates, mm-hmm. then would be still falling through the cracks.
I think that's right, Chair Ringo, although I will tell you that the bacteria testing, that's one of the things we're most concerned about, of course, is bacteriological quality of water, because that, you know, if it's bad, that's an immediate kind of thing that needs to be dealt with, if it's E. coli, for example. But there are some chemicals also that have more immediate health consequences, such as nitrate. So you could, you know, truthfully, you could narrow it down some more. But then when you look at the detections or how many test results are out there that exceed some level for a chemical, there aren't very many of those either.
Okay.
So it's still a pretty small group.
Thank you, Senator Beyer. Okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your testimony. Let's close the public hearing on Senate Bill 347, and the committee's adjourned.
Thank you for coming in.